It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster
conquered the street.
We like fighting a woman.
What is with this company's obsession with ninjas?
Oh my God, we're only an hour in. We have two more hours of this.
Come over here and fight me.
Too many ninjas.
You haven't been beat up properly.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
This is episode 672 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, October 4th, 2020. I am the Solo Monster. It is NXT TakeOver 31 tonight. I'm going to be live on YouTube as soon as TakeOver goes off the air to recap the entire show. Before we even get to that, though, later on here on this podcast, I'm going to be going through the entire card, giving predictions. We're going to talk TakeOver. We're going to talk WrestleMania here in a second. WWE taking over people's Twitch accounts. Huge change, massive change in the hierarchy of New Japan Pro Wrestling. James Storm talks about how close he came earlier this year to joining WWE and whether or not it still might happen. It's just a ton of stuff to get into. And all the things that happened this week in history, it's going to blow your mind. So we don't have any time to waste here, but the first thing I want to mention, I'm very excited about this. I've been waiting many weeks to get this up. It's been a while since we've gotten a new shirt up in the store on Pro Wrestling Tees, and I'm happy to announce that there is a brand new t-shirt up right now on prowrestlingtees.com/solomonstersoundsoff. You got to type in the full name of the show. But we are coming up in about a month or so on the 13-year anniversary of this podcast. Next month, it's going to be 13 years since the very first episode of The Sound Of dropped, and there is a new 13-year anniversary shirt that is in the spirit of, well, I'll let you see for yourself. It's very cool. It's kind of fits the whole spirit of the Halloween season, which is why I wanted to get it up early here in the month of October. But you can probably put two and two together. We're playing off the whole 13 theme. It's great. I love it. I got my own shirt on the way. I hope you guys will check it out and consider picking up a shirt for yourself. Go to prowrestlingtees.com/solomonstersoundsoff. I'll show it to you on the stream tonight, but I wanted to let everybody know who might want to go ahead and take advantage of the 13-year anniversary shirt. We usually have a new anniversary shirt every year. This one is my favorite one. Of all the ones I've ever put out going back to, I think the 8-year anniversary was the first anniversary shirt that we did. This one is by far my favorite. So hopefully you guys will go and check that on out. Support the show. WrestleMania 36 this year was supposed to take place at Raymond James Stadium in Tampa, Florida. They had the whole pirate ship theme. Jean-Pierre Lafitte was going to Tarzan swing in during the main event, only to be stopped by Paul Burchill, which would have ended in a sword fight, and Drew McIntyre winning the title from Brock Lesnar on a distraction roll-up. But thanks to COVID, none of that happened. COVID ruined it all. Ruined all the big plans. But you heard it here first. My sources told me that directly, that that was the plan for the main event. So Tampa got screwed out of WrestleMania, and so did all the Hall of Fame inductees who were scheduled to, you know, go in this year and give their speeches. It would only be fair for next year's inductees to be this year's Hall of Fame class. Just bump this year's Hall of Fame class to next year. That was to be Batista, Hogan, Hall, and Nash. And I guess they were throwing Waltman in there too from the NWO. And Hogan's a Tampa guy, so for him it would have been local. The Bella Twins were going in, JBL, Jushin Thunder Liger. And the deceased entry this year, the deceased legend, would have been the British Bulldog, Davey Boy Smith. Although, you know, Liger, if Liger is not able to travel here to the States by then, and it's still many months away, but you think about March, you think about April, when it comes to travel restrictions and things of that nature, who knows if a lot of those restrictions even then will be lifted or relaxed in some way. And, realistically, why the hell would he even want to come here with everything going on? I would say the U.S. is the last place that I would want to fly to. If I'm Liger, I'm like, yeah, you know what? I think I'll stay home. I think I'm going to stay right here in Japan. I ain't coming to your country. Not until you get your house in order. I ain't coming to your country. But yeah, that would really suck if they do move forward with the Hall of Fame and he's not able to be there in person to accept. I remember him doing interviews. He was very honored when he found out that he was being inducted. Clearly, it would have meant a lot to travel to the States in front of this whole other audience to receive any kind of accolade. You know, it's not like WWE does that very often. And I know he would probably want to be there in person to accept. So if they move ahead with it, and he either is not going to be part of it, or he has to send in some kind of pre-taped video, that would suck. But it looks like Tampa is going to be getting their WrestleMania after all, a year later than expected. That is the news, per Gary Cassidy of Inside the Ropes, who broke the story. And other websites have now followed up on that. The WWE is looking to run Raymond James Stadium in Tampa for WrestleMania 37 next year, and not SoFi Stadium in Los Angeles, which had been the plan. SoFi is a brand new stadium. They were going to go with the whole WrestleMania goes Hollywood theme again. I don't know if they would have given us those movie trailers, those parody movie trailers like they did back for WrestleMania 21. I was kind of hoping they would. I love those trailers. I go back every now and then and I come across one on YouTube. And they're great. They were great promotion for the event. And I assume that was going to kind of be the whole theme of Mania going back to the Hollywood area next year. And that does not look like it's going to happen, which you could have surmised that on your own. It's far more likely that they're going to be able to run in Florida with limited capacity fans in the stands than they would in California, even by March. You look at what's going on in California and the restrictions there. You know, again, March is a number of months away, but probably more of a sure thing if they were to go to Florida than California. And that's all we know so far. WWE has not confirmed the story. They have not denied the story. Everything is probably very fluid. It may not be a done deal. But this looks to be the current plan at the moment. WrestleVotes on Twitter backs up the news and said that there are contractual obligations that first need to be sorted out between WWE and the state of California if they were to pull out of the deal. So it's possible they're trying to work through those issues. I think you just delay it by a year. I don't know if they have something on the schedule already at SoFi for the following year, if they would even have an event on the docket that far in advance. But to me, you just push it back by a year and just say, look, we're going to bring the show to you in 2022 instead of 2021. It's like everything just gets pushed back by a year. I mean, honestly, I didn't think WWE would want to run a stadium show if they only were allowed to have 10 or 15,000 people in the building. But if they're going to run with people, you know, in the audience, AEW does it every week at Daly's Place, which is an outdoor venue. They do it at around 15% capacity each week. So they probably have anywhere from 500 to 1,000, maybe 1,500 people in the building, maybe not even that many. You know, if WWE can get 15 to 20,000 people into the stadium, all spaced out, all wearing masks, they're outdoors. You know, I don't know that the acoustics would be all that great in a place that big that's mostly empty. I'm sure they could pipe in their fake, you know, their fake crowd noise. I don't know how that would work. If you know, you're going to have actual people there. You don't want to drown them out with fake crowd noise. You want that real. If you're going to have people there, you want that real kind of audience noise. So acoustically, I'm not sure how that's going to play, being in a venue that big with a small number of people. But I'll tell you what, it beats the hell out of running the Performance Center. If you're watching the show on TV for the visual experience, it beats the hell out of the PC. And the Thunderdome, it doesn't look like it's going to be around much longer. That deal is up at the end of the month. I have no idea if they're going to extend it. And even if they do, they're not going to extend it for another 6 months. So, you know, the Thunderdome is on borrowed time. So that may be the best way to go for WrestleMania. You know, look, I want everybody to be safe. I want everybody to be smart. And if they can do that, then sure. You know, let's get some fans in there for WrestleMania. 15,000 people inside the stadium, which means they'll announce an attendance of 40,000. I mean, it's what they do. It would not be a true WrestleMania if they didn't exaggerate the attendance numbers. But the other question is, do they run one night or do they run two? like they did at the PC this year. If they insist on having 15 matches, squeezing everybody on the card to try to get everybody, a payday, then it would have to be two nights. The seven-hour WrestleManias, that needs to be a thing of the past. That needs to just die. They are exhausting. WrestleMania should never, ever be that long again on a single night. You want to spread it out over two nights? Fine. Seven, 7.5, even 6.5 hours. Look, I've sat through it live. I haven't just watched it on TV. I've been in the building live for some of those shows. It is exhausting. And it kills the crowd. By the time you get into those last couple of matches, the main event, you know, we're always talking about what should headline, what should go on last. I'll tell you what, you know, when you have a long show like that, if I'm one of the matches being considered for the main event, I'm probably arguing to go on third from last or in the middle of the show like Daniel Bryan and Kofi Kingston did this last year in New Jersey. Now that, obviously, there was a big story going into that match, and you know, with Kofi winning, it was a whole big emotional finish and everybody was celebrating. But then when it came for the women in the main event, you know, that thing didn't start until after midnight. And it could really kill the vibe. If I were there, I'd want to go on earlier. I wouldn't want to go on last when you have a show that long. Now, if they have the stadium to themselves and they're only having, let's say, X number of people in there anyway, and they can book it for two nights, they may as well just, you know, leave everything up and just come back the next night and divide the card into two parts like they did this year. I wasn't sure how it would come off this year. I was not sold on the idea of a two-day WrestleMania. But that was under, you know, normal circumstances, packed crowd. Would they be able to fill the building back-to-back nights? The way they did it this year in the PC, it came off well. Here, they wouldn't have to worry about packing the building each night. They'd be able to, I mean, easily. They would easily be able to get 15,000 people in there each night, all spaced out. I'm still not enamored with having that many people in one place, if we're all no better off by March than we are today. But if they're going to do it, better to do it outdoors. I did not forget about all you PayPal folks. For those of you who may be wondering how you can support the show, the easiest thing to do is just spread the word. Let people know about the Sound Off. Got friends or family members who maybe are into wrestling, let them know. Hey, I got a podcast for you to listen to. Or send them on over to the YouTube channel. There's a lot of other content up there. You can support directly, though, via PayPal. It's entirely voluntary. You can go to thesolomonster.com. It is the most direct way to support. You'll see the PayPal button on the right-hand side of that page. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out here on the show. I started doing it because people seem to love it. People seem to love it. Now we have our whole little PayPal family here. And I want to say thank you to all of our great supporters. DeVenom, John, Iru. Thank you, John. I cannot say enough about how important all these names that you hear, that I read off each week. How loyal these guys are. They listen every single week. They support. I see them on YouTube. They buy a shirt. They send the link to somebody. They're plugging the show on Twitter and tagging me. All kinds of stuff. And that just, it means the world to me. So, John, thank you. Portland pop star Paul Hamilton. Paul, I love you. John Loose Cannon Lopez. Deadpool James Herrera. Out of Control Cody Thomas. The Florida Freebird Brian Pissera. Beast Mode Brock Joseph. Killshot Keith Hart, Fast Blast Tim Banks, The Chicago Slayer Willie Eichard, Stephen Handyman Halistic, Raymond the Mountie Medina, The Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep, Mean Matt Forbush, The Sound Off Group Messiah, Jeff Lippman. Yes, he has undergone a gimmick change. He came to me, he came to the promoter, he said, look, I want to change my name. I don't want to be Shorty G anymore. I want to go back to being Chad Gable. Don't worry, I got something to say about that during the SmackDown review. But his request was granted, so all hail the Sound Off Group Messiah, Jeff Lippman. Night Stalker Naif Alsafar, B Mac Attack, Bernard Hicks, whose mother turned 63 years old on Thursday. He wanted to give her a shout out. So happy birthday to Mama Hicks. Super Jock Michael Cochran, Danger Dan Larson, Josh the Shooter Stockton, New York Punk, Arnold Modesto, Ostentatious Alan Carter, Stormy Skies, Ryan Spies, the Firebomb. I sounded Bostonian there for a second. The Firebomber, the Firebomber, Craig Foster, First Class Cameron Johnson, and Belt Fan Brent Banner, who hosts a podcast with his friend Trey Sykes called How Did We Even Get Here? Where they bust each other's chops while winding their way through all sorts of topics, including pro wrestling. This past Thursday, they were joined by a couple of models to talk dating. Check them out on Spotify. Check them out on YouTube and on Podbean at gethearpod.podbean.com. So here we go again. The top story this week, WWE banning third-party stuff when it comes to their talent. We talked about this a number of weeks ago. There was still a lot of confusion about it. I gave you my thoughts on that whole situation, what Vince McMahon was trying to do. And there was a little bit of clarification that came out of it. I think there were a lot of wrestlers who were just very unsure about exactly what the company was trying to do. And this bubbled back up this week because when that all happened, if you remember, the deadline was set. It was a deadline of October 2nd, which came and went this past Friday. October 2nd was the deadline that WWE and Vince McMahon had set for all of their talent to sever any and all third-party business relationships that they may have had. Any kind of endorsement deals, any kind of monetary relationship that they may have with services like Cameo and Twitch had to be severed by October 2nd. Or they would risk penalty in some way, fine, suspension, possibly even termination. Which I laugh at. They're not terminating anybody. But anyone who is using their WWE name and likeness to make money, where WWE itself was not making any money off those deals, that's what they wanted to cut off. And let me be clear. If somebody is using, and I said this before, and I'm going to say it again. If somebody is using their WWE name on Twitch, they built an entire channel using their WWE name on Twitch, on Cameo, and there were wrestlers, and I named who they were, who were on Cameo, for example. They were not under their real names. They were, you know, they were on there as a WWE superstar, you know, blank, whoever it was. So that was going on. Then WWE has the right to either ask them or tell them that, you know, look, you got to share in that revenue, or ask them to just stop doing that. That's fair enough. But according to a new story from Wrestling Inc., which has now been backed up by other sites like Fightful and PW Insider and The Observer, they may be taking things even farther. Vince McMahon sent an email to talent. The WWE is going to be taking control of all Twitch and Cameo accounts in 4 weeks. Once they have the logins, everyone's username, everyone's password, they're supposed to turn all that information over to the company. Once they have that, and once WWE takes control of these accounts, the talent can continue to use them, and WWE will give those individuals a percentage of the revenue generated from those accounts, which, and this is a big point, big bone of contention here, this is what has a lot of the talent up in arms, which will count against their downside guarantee. Which begs the question, as I'm sure some people are wondering, what is a downside guarantee? You've heard that before, you've heard that expression, so-and-so signed, their downside is this, their downside is that. What does that mean? Every wrestler has a downside guarantee that they sign for in WWE. For the lower card wrestlers, their downside is not going to be that much. I don't know what they are today. But, you know, it's come out years ago, not even that long ago, but years ago, it could be something for a lower card guy, like maybe $75,000 per year, maybe even $100,000, maybe somewhere in that $75,000 to $100,000, $125,000 range, right? Somewhere in there. For someone higher on the card, their downside is going to obviously be higher, into the low six figures, maybe the mid six figures. And the very top stars, it could be close to, if not $1 million or more. That means that that person will not make less than that figure for the year. they're guaranteed to make at least that much money. That does not count any additional money. Let's say business is good. It's a good year, right? A non-pandemic year, although WWE is making more money this year in the middle of a pandemic than they ever have in their history. But let's say you're in the middle of a good year, right? Business is booming. So you get extra money from the live events, right? Live event payoffs, from merchandise. If you're in the video game, that could be very lucrative. So if you have a downside guarantee, let's just say it's $250,000 a year. Your downside guarantee is pretty good. It's $250,000 a year. I'd say that's pretty good. And let's say you don't get hurt. You work all year. It's a good year. The buildings are full. You made it into the video game. Maybe you even had a t-shirt that sold really well that year. So you actually made $500,000. And then you had yourself a pretty good year because you made $500,000 that year. But if business was down, maybe you were hurt for a while, you weren't working the live events, and you didn't reach your downside. Get to the end of the year, and you didn't hit your downside. And your downside was $150,000. You only made $100,000 that year. WWE would then have to cut you a check for the other $50,000 at the end of the year to make up for what you're owed. So that's my understanding of how it works, how it still works in WWE. The numbers may be different, but that, generally speaking, is how a downside guarantee would work. So what's the problem here? PW Insider spoke with a ton of different talents in the company. So did Fightful. But there was a report specifically from Mike Johnson on PW Insider. He spoke to a ton of different talents under the condition of anonymity. Nobody wanted to be named publicly. Who claimed that they were told a month ago, and this all first bubbled up. They were told a month ago, and they were under the impression that if they maintained a presence on these different services, like Twitch, not using their WWE name and likeness, if it was their own personal channel, their own brand, their own name, that they would not be affected by this. And from the sounds of that, that is no longer the case. It sounds like WWE plans to take control of their accounts regardless of whether or not they're using their WWE name. Now, WWE needs to clarify this ASAP, because it could just be another misunderstanding, and they're being just very overly vague with these email messages, and the talent is confused. They immediately think the worst, they're panicking, this is ridiculous, this doesn't make any sense. But it sounds like more than just a few. This is the impression that they're under, is that it applies to their account even if they have stripped it of any and all mentions of WWE. The fact that they're only going to get a cut on a certain percentage of those earnings now is also very frustrating. You know, you figure Twitch takes, I don't know what Twitch takes actually. Let's say Twitch takes 50%, right? Or whatever it may be. I mean, I know, for example, all these services work differently. But for example, you know, I do a lot of live streaming on YouTube. YouTube introduced Super Chats some time ago, which was a game changer for a lot of streamers because now people were, and now they have memberships and things like that on YouTube, but it was a game changer because if you were somebody who streamed a lot, you know, it's no different than on Twitch and other services. You get tips and bits and all that kind of stuff. But Google has the system set up where when you get Super Chats, the content creator nets 70% and YouTube takes 30%, which is a sizable percentage, but you know, at least they're not taking 50. But yeah, if I'm doing a stream and I do, you know, reasonably well in a given night, you know, I let's say $300 on a big pay-per-view stream in Super Chats, I ain't getting $300 because Google's taking their 30%, right? Everybody has different percentages. Let's just say Twitch is taking 50%. Then WWE now is going to take its cut and they'll decide how much the talent then gets. We don't know what that percentage is. It could be 5%, it could be 10%, it could be 15%. We don't know. If Zelina Vega had a, and she does have a Twitch, but if Zelina Vega had a Twitch under that name, look, that would be one thing. But if she has one under Thea Trinidad, and it has nothing to do with her WWE persona, yes, people would recognize her from WWE television. Yes, there would be an inherent benefit for her if people said, hey, that's Zelina Vega from WWE, and they wanted to come into her stream, and all they wanted to do was ask her WWE questions and talk about WWE. But look, if she's running it under her real name, and she's playing games, and she's doing non-WWE things, you know what? WWE can piss off. That's ridiculous. Not only that, but as WWE now wants to start to partner with or expand its own presence on Twitch, which is really what this is about, they want to get in on the whole Twitch thing, right? They want to partner up and buddy up with Twitch and have everybody and everything go through them. That's what they're trying to do. They're trying to find new ways to make money off of these people because they're a company that tours. Like Icecapades, right? They're a touring brand that is unable to tour. And there's no indication of when they'll be able to go back to touring. And even when they do, they're not going to be touring as much. That seems pretty obvious. They were already scaling back on a lot of their live events even before the pandemic hit. So here you have this publicly traded company that is very cash rich and still doing very well financially at the moment. But they're looking for new ways. Hey, who can we make money off of? How can we bring in new sources of revenue? Hey, look at all these people. Look at all the money they're making. Look at all the money Paige is bringing in every single month on Twitch. How can we get our cut? We got these people under contract. How can we squeeze them so we can get more money out of this? That's what they're trying to do. But then there's this from the PW Insider report. Says the one connecting frustration across all talents who are upset is the realization that they will soon be required to stream and appear on Twitch as part of their WWE booking contracts. All of the talents told a very similar story, which is that instead of letting WWE take them over, they will still be booked to appear and stream as part of WWE's planned larger scale Twitch presence going forward. Talent appearances will be just another appearance for the company, no different from a match on a house show or an autograph signing, and would not result in an extra payday. Instead, those Twitch appearances will morph into another requirement of the talent's booking contracts as part of their downside guarantee. So whatever sense of freedom they felt by having their own channel, that is now being completely taken away from them. And they are no longer making any extra money because it counts against their downside, in which case, why the hell even bother to maintain a channel anymore at all? But even if they give up their channel, there's still going to be a requirement for them to stream. It's like they have to do it now no matter what. It's now part of the job description all of a sudden. It wasn't when they signed that contract. You signed a WWE contract 2-3 years ago. There was no provision in there. There was no requirement for streaming on YouTube or streaming on Twitch. All of a sudden, the company wants to change that. They want to insert that. They want to make it part of your everyday responsibilities. But they ain't going to pay you anything for it. They're not going to pay you anything extra for it. Or if you do get a little bit of the percentage that, you know, they're going to cut you in on, I'm sure it's going to be a sliver. It's not going to be that much. But yeah, why even bother having a channel anymore? If you are somebody who does it for, if you're a wrestler who does it for the extra income, if that is your main reason for going on Twitch, you want to make some extra money on the side, it's like your side hustle, then you're no longer going to get that extra income, or at least not nearly as much to make it worth your while. And if you're somebody who doesn't really do it for the money, you just do it because it was fun and you can sort of just lounge out and be yourself. Well, now it's not so fun anymore because now it's work. They effectively want you to do more work for the same amount of pay. Yeah, I can understand why they would be upset about that. Now, if you remember Andrew Yang, his name came up. He took a great interest in this story a few weeks ago because he is a wrestling fan. He did run for president. He is talking about how in the next administration, he may have some influence. He may even have a position. Yeah, you know, if I'm WWE, I got my eyes and ears open and I'm paying attention to this whole thing. So he's been very vocal about this. And he heard this news and he's heard from a lot of wrestlers who have reached out to him, apparently. This is what he tweeted. He said, "This would be infuriating to me if I had spent time building up my social media channels only to have WWE take them over from their independent, quote-unquote, independent contractors. People are angry, and rightfully so. Hearing from talent that WWE is forcing performers to sign new contracts that include Twitch. Streaming on Twitch will become a work obligation, and if talent does not stream, they will forego earnings, be suspended, or face penalties. Does not sound like independent contractors." Yang also spoke to Wrestling Inc. and said this. He said, "A lot of it is that wrestlers are afraid to speak out. I've had wrestlers past and present reach out to me and say that Vince McMahon has been getting away with exploitation of wrestlers, calling themselves independent contractors while controlling their activities for years and years." Which, of course, you know, we already knew that. He said, "A lot of it is just that they have a quasi-monopoly, and wrestlers fear that if they do try to unionize or organize in some way that Vince doesn't like, that they will never work there again." To me, though, this right here was the key line at the very end of the story. This was the key line of the entire thing. It says, "They also noted that a lot of talent is livid, but as is usually the case in these situations, nobody would speak up about it." And therein lies the problem. This is exactly what I said the last time we talked about this. Somebody has to be willing to stand up and put their name on this publicly and not just speak anonymously to wrestling news websites and politicians like Andrew Yang. The only way that any of this possibly changes is if you get half a dozen or more wrestlers, including some prominent names, maybe not even the biggest name, but some prominent names on that WWE roster, the Raw roster, the SmackDown roster, to stand up to Vince McMahon and say, "Look, you're overstepping your bounds here. Now you're taking this too far. We're not doing this. We're not signing on for this." He's not going to fire half of his roster. I mean, first of all, it'll be a PR disaster. But he's not going to fire half of his roster. I know he's got more talent now than he's ever had under contract at any one moment, but you can't just dump, you know, all these people and just plug a whole new bunch of bodies in and expect people not to notice. That's not how this works. You've invested a lot of television time in a lot of these people for months, for years in some cases. They're not just going to fire all of those people if all of a sudden they speak up publicly. It's all about strength in numbers. It always is. Strength in numbers. But they don't have the guts to do it. And look, I wouldn't want to be the only person who raises their hand at that meeting either. I would like to know that if I'm going to stand up and raise my hand, that I've got some other people willing to back me up on this. But unless the talent revolts against it, nothing is ever going to change. First of all, if they're putting new contracts in front of talent and saying, "Hey, sign here." And we've heard, we've heard tons of stories. I've heard stories and read stories going back to the early to mid-80s. The Wendi Richter story, when Wendi Richter was the women's champion before the whole Spider Lady incident, the first screw job when they took the title away from her, they had Moolah in the Spider Lady costume screw Wendi Richter out of the women's title, and that was the end of Wendi Richter in WWE. The story where she was about to go out, it might have been that night, for her match, and Gorilla Monsoon is waiting at the gorilla position. "Here, sign this, we got a new contract for you." Didn't give her a chance to read it or anything, and I think she refused to sign it. And then came the screw job, if I'm remembering that story correctly. So there's always been stories about people, "Hey, here, sign this." They don't want you to have time to look it over. And the last thing they want you to do is say, "Hey, I'm going to have my lawyer look it over." You dare say the word lawyer in front of Vince McMahon, you're dead to him. He is notorious for hating lawyers. He's got one of the best legal teams in the world. Oh yeah, I'm sure his lawyers are great. He loves those lawyers. He loves Jerry McDevitt. He loves all those lawyers. But he's notorious for that. Stories where wrestlers wanted to bring their lawyer to, like, their contract negotiation. He hates that. Hates that. He would rather just deal with the performer one-on-one. Of course he would. Of course he would. Of course he doesn't want a lawyer in the room with him. But if they're putting contracts in front of the talent saying, "Here, sign here." It's the same contract, but it's got a few extra clauses in there covering Twitch and Cameo and other services. "We need you to sign this." And guess what? Don't sign it. If your Twitch is that important to you, or your freedom is that important to you, or you're naive enough to believe that, oh, well, I'm an independent contractor. If you really believe that, then regardless of how, you know, much money you may be making, and maybe you're doing well, maybe you're making a lot of money, maybe you don't need Twitch, but it just bothers you that they're doing this, just say no. It's very simple. Just say no. That's number one. Number two, WWE is really opening itself up to problems here if they keep barking up this tree. You know, protecting their intellectual property is one thing. You can't be Rusev on Twitch and make money. You can't be Paige on Twitch anymore and make money without WWE getting a cut. Fine. Then he'll be Miro and she'll be Saraya. They should not have any right to tell people that even under their real names, the name on their drive, I don't give a shit what the language in the contract is. I'm just talking about this in terms of just basic fairness and common sense. Yes, it is possible there is language in the contracts that they signed that actually does allow WWE to do this. That doesn't make it right. That doesn't make it right. They should not have any right to tell people that even under their real names, the names on their driver's license, we want you to turn your account over to us. Give us your password. Give us your login. It's just wrong. And I want to see these people stand up for themselves. If it matters that much to them, if they're that, what was the word in the report there? Livid. A lot of the talent is livid. Oh, really? Well, if they're that livid, then they need to take a stand and say no more. Otherwise, you get what you deserve. The next time you sign your name on that piece of paper, you do so with the understanding that you are signing your life away. Unless you're an NXT talent, of course, throwing a fucking party in the middle of a pandemic, in which case when you ask Triple H, as somebody did on the conference call before TakeOver this week, are there going to be any penalties for the people who threw the party? He'll tell you, well, gee, you know, there's nothing we can do. We can't police people and control what they do in their personal lives. You know, when it suits their agenda, they don't seem to have any problem telling people what to do in their personal lives. Throw a fucking party, though, and I guess, well, gee, there's nothing we can do about that. We can't tell them what to do. I guess that's where they draw the line. They need to put out a clarification about this first thing tomorrow morning. First thing Monday morning. Not for me. I don't work for the company. Not for me, not for you, not for the fans, but for their own talent. I almost said employees. I can't even use that word. But they need to, first thing Monday morning, put out a, that's what they did last time. I don't even think they waited. I think on Sunday, they had to put some kind of statement out. They need to issue an immediate clarification about what the policy is, because there are a lot of people who just sound very confused. Maybe they're wrong. Maybe they're misunderstanding and misinterpreting this entire thing. If the talent have it all wrong, and this is not what WWE is doing, then Vince McMahon personally, this is not enough to just put a statement out from the PR department. Vince McMahon himself, now I know he's been apparently getting to the buildings really late, very cavalierly, he's coming to Raw late this week. They didn't even sit down to start writing the fucking show on Monday until 2 o'clock in the afternoon. People apparently had no idea what they were doing on the show that night. They were at the building, but they didn't know what they were doing because the show wasn't even written yet. Until Vince came in, he sat down with everybody, and apparently at 2 p.m., hey, let's put together Monday Night Raw for 8 o'clock tonight. So I don't know when he's going to get to the building, but here's what he needs to do. He's the face of the company. He's the owner, he's the chairman, he's the CEO, he's the head cheese. Vince McMahon has to personally sit them down in the back tomorrow night at the Thunderdome, and again on Friday with the other roster. Or, you know, maybe he could even wait until he gets them all together. We got a draft coming up this week. They may have the rosters together anyway. And very clearly explain to everybody what the actual policy is. And then take questions. Take Q&A. If there is a lesson to be learned this week, it is that you have to be transparent with people. Because otherwise, you're going to have a million different stories going around. Some of it true, some of it not true. And then you're going to be left to clean up the mess. But if this turns out to be accurate, as I'm reading this, and as Andrew Yang says that he's got WWE talent telling him, if this all turns out to be exactly what we think it is, Vince McMahon had better tread lightly. All he's doing is poking the bear. And if he keeps pushing on this, it's going to blow up in his face. With the G1 climax in full swing, the board of directors for Bushiroad, the majority owner of New Japan Pro Wrestling, has made the decision to replace current CEO Harold Mage later this month in a major shakeup. See what I did there? He will remain the CEO of the company until October 23rd, when he will be replaced by Takami Obari, the current CEO of New Japan America. According to a report in The Observer, Mage was not well-liked by a lot of people in the company who thought that he was very divisive. They thought that he had a big ego, and they blame him for bungling things with the North American talent that left the company last year, which may have played a direct role in there being no working relationship at the moment between New Japan and AEW. There's always seemed to be this underlying tension, right? There's no, I don't say hatred, but there's definitely been some bad feelings, probably on both sides. And there's been this resistance to having any kind of real discussions between the two sides. You know, certainly you look at the NWA, Billy Corgan and the NWA, they've had an open line of communication recently with AEW, and they've been able to work together. And a lot of people have been wondering, what's going on with New Japan and AEW? And whatever angst might be there, hard feelings might be there, it seems like Mage is being blamed for the bulk of it. Now, per The Observer, Tony Khan said that he is not yet sure how this move might play out for them, but his initial gut feeling is that it could be a good thing for the two sides. And there was an unnamed top star in AEW who said that they have no idea if Mage being out means that they might open up a working relationship now at New Japan, but that they want to do it. There is a desire to want to do it. Mage was, in their words, an idiot when it came to understanding the wrestling business. This is according, again, to this unnamed top AEW star. Even though Mage has been he'd been a fan for many years, it's not like you hear stories about Jim Herd being brought in to lead WCW in the early 90s, didn't know what he was doing, he was an executive doing non-wrestling things, what did he know about the wrestling business? Mage, by all accounts, was a wrestling fan, still is, worked for other companies like Coca-Cola and different places, and ended up in charge of New Japan. But they're hopeful, this person in AEW says that they're hopeful that things now might change with him leaving. I've said this all year long. You guys have heard me talk about this time and time again. You have a lot of the top talent in AEW that have worked for New Japan. Right? Cody's worked there. Omega's worked there. The Bucks have worked there. Hangman Page has worked there. Others have worked there as well. That have established themselves to that New Japan audience. They have built a fan base, not only in this country, but in Japan as well. And they want to do business together, but whatever it was, there was always this underlying tension. And when New Japan lost their Access TV deal here in the States, that was a big blow to them. They didn't want to get into bed with Impact. They were given this ultimatum by Anthem. You know, if you want to have a working relationship with Impact, you know, they might still be on Access TV today. But they didn't want to do it. They had a working relationship with Ring of Honor. There was bad blood from past years with Impact, even though that was a totally different administration. It is kind of silly if New Japan doesn't want to work with Impact for that reason alone, because the people who were in charge at that time, I mean, that was many, many, many years ago. You think about when Russo was, you know, booking a young Okada and stuff like that. I mean, that's ancient history at this point. But whatever it is, they didn't want to work with Impact. And when they lost that TV deal, it made it that much more important for them to get back in front of an American audience. And that's why it makes sense for them to want to strike up some kind of a deal, I'm sure, with AEW, because AEW has this great time slot, live television on TNT, one of the big major cable networks in this country every single week. And it's possible that they could get some of their big names in front of an American audience on TNT, at least until they're able to get a TV deal of their own. I mean, New Japan set up an entire American division to try to do just that. They wanted to expand. They still want to expand their footprint here in America. And that has really hit a wall since losing that TV deal. And then the pandemic hit, and they haven't been able to run any shows in this country. I want both sides to work together. I say this as a fan. I want both sides to work together. It is the talent exchange that we need. AEW has a surplus of tag teams. They have the most robust tag team division probably of any promotion anywhere in the world. They have so many tag teams, they don't even know what to do with all of them. Now imagine sending, if they're not doing anything, let's say on TV, so for a few weeks, you're going to send the Lucha Bros over for the New Japan Tag League. Send Private Party over. We're best friends. Imagine getting Kota Ibushi on TNT. You don't think that once they get crowds back into the buildings in front of those fans, the AEW fan base, that someone like Ibushi would not come across like a superstar? We already know that he would. We have evidence that he would. We have proof that he would. Look no further than the Cruiserweight Classic in WWE. Kota Ibushi worked with WWE before he ever worked with AEW. WWE wanted him in the worst way, and he was smart enough to say no. Kota Ibushi, you know, sometimes I watch his matches and the abuse that he takes landing on the back of his neck all the time, and I think, boy, this is not a very smart person. But turning down WWE was probably the single smartest thing that he ever did in his entire career. He had the best matches of the whole tournament. He had Full Sail on their feet. Those are the kind of fans that you'll find at AEW events. You don't think this guy would get over like a superstar, like a fucking rock star? Or you know, someone like Ishii, that he wouldn't come over and also get over? Imagine sending Jungle Boy or Darby Allin to take part in the Super Juniors. So there's a lot of synergy. There's a lot, I think, that these companies could do together that the fans would really be excited about. Now, Meiji, he did oversee a very lucrative period for New Japan. They were able to survive the pandemic largely off the back of the revenue that they generated from running those two Tokyo Dome shows at the beginning of the year. The first time they have ever run back-to-back nights at the Tokyo Dome. That came under the direction of Meiji. And they didn't have to cut a single person during the pandemic. They didn't cut one wrestler. They didn't cut a single wrestler's pay during that entire time. People in the front office took pay cuts. Some of the executives supposedly took pay cuts so that they didn't have to take it out on the talent. Meiji had his own fan club, which was very unusual for an executive to have a fan club. It's like Bruce Pritchard. Bruce having a fan club. I can't even fathom such a thing. I'm sure he must through his show with Conrad. He's got a lot of fans out there. But it'd be like Bruce Pritchard having his own fan club or something like that. It'd be very strange. It'd be very weird. And apparently that rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. I guess it goes to the whole thing about him having a big ego. But also, you know, in the Observer report, it mentioned that he would often greet fans as they entered the buildings, and he would shake hands with them, and he would hand out items to them. See, I find that endearing. I don't know if that was brought up in the report as sort of a knock on the guy. Maybe it's not the traditional way of doing things in Japan. That doesn't even seem like it's the traditional way of doing things here in this country either. Although when I would go to Ring of Honor shows, Joe Koff, from Sinclair, he would always be walking around at the Ring of Honor events. You know, there were multiple times where I was just sitting in my seat and I would turn and he's standing next to me watching the show. You know, I'd strike up a conversation with the guy. He was always, you know, personable enough. Sometimes I'd see him or people like at the front when people would come in, but it is a rare thing. I find that endearing. I don't find anything wrong with that at all. I don't find anything wrong with the CEO of the company wanting to meet and greet fans as they enter the building. Only in wrestling. Only in wrestling would you have people upset that the CEO would greet fans entering the buildings thinking that he was trying to get himself over. Just get himself over for what? What does that even mean? He's trying to get himself over. To what, beat Okada for the title? That's only a thing here in America. You don't got to worry about that in Japan. We've had CEOs, we've had head writers in WWE and WCW putting themselves over and winning world titles. Not in New Japan. Harold Mage in the G1 is when New Japan would have jumped the shark for me. But I don't see anything wrong with that at all. The other stuff, that's a different story. I can't speak to that because I don't work there, but obviously there are a lot of people who were not part of the Harold Mage fan club. They didn't have their membership renewed for the big fan club. And it sounds to me like we may have just taken a giant leap. It's too early to know for sure, but it sounds like we may have taken one giant step towards a dialogue, a real dialogue, possibly opening up between New Japan and AEW. And that's a great thing. As I said before, Raw last Monday night was only finalized at the last minute this week. Vince McMahon and the writers, they didn't even get together, reportedly, to start putting the show together until about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. We're basically at late-stage WCW levels at this point. That's basically where we have arrived at. This is a company that's a lot more solvent. They have a lot more money and resources than WCW did. They're not in jeopardy the way WCW was. But we've basically arrived at late-stage WCW at this point. No Retribution or Raw Underground this week. That automatically adds about 3 points to the Raw score for this week. Because of the COVID outbreak, they did not have access to all of the trainees that they usually would have in the crowd for the Raw Underground stuff, so they ditched it for 1 week. It's supposedly going to probably be back on TV tomorrow night. They could ditch it permanently, for all I care. They tried something new. I even said, of the two ideas, Retribution and Raw Underground, which popped up the same week on TV, this is the one I thought could have had potential. I was, you know, pitching this idea about Bobby Lashley. He looked like such a badass in the Underground that first week, and maybe that could become his lair, and then that could be a way to reintroduce Brock Lesnar at some point and start building to something with Lashley and Lesnar. And, you know, look, Lashley's still in a good spot. I like the Hurt Business stuff. They didn't go in that direction, obviously. And maybe Lesnar just doesn't want to come back right now. Maybe Brock Lesnar wants to take some time off. He'll come back around WrestleMania season like he always does. But as far as I'm concerned, now that I've had about a month or so, or month or more, of Raw Underground and the camera cuts, and I see what this segment has become, and they build up, you know, Yabba Dabba Doo guy only to have him beat by Braun Strowman. As far as I'm concerned, they could ditch the whole damn thing for all I care. They tried something new. I don't think it has added anything of value to the show. You could say the same about Retribution. Some of the members were exposed to people who tested positive for COVID, so as a precautionary measure, they were kept off the show, and they're probably going to be off the show tomorrow night as well. I don't think they're actually supposed to be back on the show until next week, hopefully. I say hopefully for them, hopefully. The best thing they could do, honestly, at this point, this could be a blessing in disguise. They disappear from TV. The best thing they could do is to just say that, you know, Teabag and Slapdick and the rest of them, they open their own Twitch accounts, and they have refused to hand over their login credentials to WWE management, so they have voided their contracts. And just be done with it. There you go. There it is, right? That's all you gotta do. Their Twitch is so very important, and actually Mia Yim does have a Twitch. But there's your story. They refused to hand over their login name and their password to Vince McMahon, and their contracts have thereby been voided. They have a draft coming up, right? This Friday is when the draft begins. It starts Friday. It ends next Monday. Just draft the key members of Retribution to different shows. Drop the Halloween masks and let us never speak of this again. They can still be saved. They can still be rescued. Their careers don't have to end in shame and just mocking and pointing and laughing. They can still be saved. There's still time. The key story on this show from Monday night was Randy Orton threatening Drew McIntyre in the opening segment and then seemingly leaving the building. He took his luggage, he was leaving the building. McIntyre was in the ring at the time with all of the legends that Orton punted in the head, and Christian. They all interfered in the ambulance match at Clash of Champions, and they got their revenge on Orton, Big Show, and Flair, and Shawn Michaels. Flair didn't do anything. I mean, Flair just drove the ambulance away, but he was out there as well. So they showed up the next night. They were in the ring with Drew. And for the rest of the night, they stayed in the back in what they called the Legends Lounge, playing poker. And during the show, throughout the night, they would periodically check in on the game of poker, and we would see them, you know, just kind of having a good time and playing the game. But you knew that there was a reason for this, and you knew that something bad was going to befall these men. We got a rematch for the Raw Women's title, Asuka defending against Zelina Vega. What did I say in my pay-per-view recap? As sure as I know my own name, I said there's going to be a rematch, which I guess you could have predicted anyway, because if you remember after the match at Clash of Champions, they were bowing and Zelina kicked Asuka and ran off. You just knew they couldn't help themselves and they would book a rematch. Even though Zelina entered as the challenger, she lost, she tapped out, so what do? Let's do it again. Let's just do it again. Now, I actually enjoyed the rematch more than I think I did their match at Clash of Champions. I think it was a slightly better match. Doesn't change the fact that there was no need for this match to happen. Asuka got her to tap out again. No Angel Garza on the show, who was hurt at the pay-per-view, but Andrade did the J-O-B to Keith Lee. And he came out, after Zelina, I think it was after Zelina's loss, is when Andrade came out, and he was yelling at her. He was trashing her on the microphone, so it sounds like that partnership, that alliance is over. I think that's a big mistake. Andrade's English is still not great. He really should not be cutting promos for himself. He really shouldn't. I mean, there are guys in the company who, whether it's Garza, you've got Santos Escobar in NXT, who can easily cut promos that WWE, I'm sure, would love. You know, they can cut promos. Their English is good enough, I'm sure, to please the old man. Andrade is never going to get anywhere. He's just not going to get anywhere. And he's a talented guy. He's one of the most talented guys they have on that roster. Splitting him away from Vega, not giving him a manager or a mouthpiece, is going to doom this guy. It's going to really hurt him. And I think Zelina is much better off in the managerial role anyway. She could show off more of her personality that way. She's very good in that role. It doesn't look like they're going to be in any rush to put her back in that spot. You know, I understand that they need new faces in the women's division. God knows I've been talking about this now for a long time. I'm not sure she's the answer. And I'm not sure that that's going to be the best role for her. So if she is really moving away from the managing, I think that's too bad. Because it really is the best role for her. But yes, Andrade did the job to Keith Lee here on this show. No Angel Garza. At the pay-per-view, looked like he hurt his leg. Garza posted a video this week, and Espanol, on his YouTube channel, a few days ago, talking about the injury that he did suffer in that Raw Tag Team title match. It looked like a leg injury, either a knee injury, maybe a quad. There was talk of maybe a quad tear. Nobody was sure. Thankfully, and it is a quad tear apparently, but it's not as serious as originally feared. Here's what he said. This translation comes courtesy of Carlos Toro on Fightful.com. This is directly from Angel Garza himself. He explained that when Montez Ford went for a kick and I grabbed the kick, when I lowered it, I went for the knee. He's going to give him a knee lift. But I put in a little too much force. I thought when I was going to do it, he was a little too far from where I was, and I didn't measure myself properly. When I tried to stretch my leg towards him, the other leg that was supporting it couldn't handle it, and it was stretched out too much. That's when I heard a small pop, like a balloon exploding. Everything around that area started to get really hot. And when I tried to move my leg, I had that tension close to my groin, and it was my quadriceps almost reaching my hip. That's what I felt. The referee came to me and asked me if I can continue, and I said no. I remember giving Andrade the tag, and he asked me what's wrong, and I told him that I can't go anymore. WWE has a system that's really effective when they have all the doctors and medical personnel watching the matches on monitors, and they quickly go to the ring to see what's going on. I told them what I was feeling. The medical team sent me away to get it checked. And they told me to get an MRI. I got the results, and thankfully it wasn't anything involving the tendons or anything with my hip, as some outlets have reported. It was a quad tear, and we already have begun treatment. It says I've been putting ice on it and bandages for the tear. Right now, I just came from an evaluation, and we have been advancing through it incredibly. I still have more evaluations to do, but if all goes well, I think I might be out from a week to maybe 15 days. Thank God it wasn't anything long-term like 5 or 6 months. They told me if I had continued, I could have completely torn the quad and would have been out for a very long time. I don't think it will be even a month to fully recover. So he's estimating that he may be out for another couple of weeks, and then he might be able to come back. So that's great news. Yeah, I think quad tear, I think of Triple H. Triple H has had 2 quad tears, 1 in each leg. Both times, they kept him out for anywhere from 7 to 9 months. That's a long recovery. So if he can escape this by being out for 3 weeks, then good for him. I don't think you want to rush back too quickly from any kind of tear like that. Especially a guy like him, he's a smaller guy, he moves around a lot, he does these aerial moves, he does Spanish flies off the top rope all the time. Take your time, make sure you heal up properly. That's great news, though, that he's not going to be out for a long time. They are keeping the Mysterio family drama going with Rollins and Murphy. Days of Our Lives here on Monday Night Raw. There was a King's Court segment, Jerry Lawler in the ring to interview the Mysterio family. If I'm Rey Mysterio, I'm keeping my eye on the King in the ring there with my 19-year-old daughter. Seth Rollins revealed a text message exchange from Murphy's phone between Murphy and Aaliyah. The family was very upset with her, and she was upset with them. And, you know, for being naive, she was very offended by this, and she stormed to the back. I thought she was fine, honestly, in this segment. I saw some hate for her acting skills. Look, the girl is 19 years old. She's never been on television a day in her life until this storyline. She was fine. There was nothing wrong with Aaliyah. Dominic had a match with Murphy where Dominic grabbed a kendo stick and his sister ran out to stop him from hurting Murphy. He told her to get out of here. And when Dominic got back into the ring, his sister was pleading with him, stop, stop, don't do it. Murphy, with him distracted, Murphy rolled him up for the win. And that set up a confrontation after the match between brother and sister. And Dominic said, you know, you really are naive. And she slapped him in the face. Not quite a Stephanie McMahon-esque slap, but she slapped him in the face. And she walked off. Chris Van Vliet interviewed Dominic. He put a clip up from the interview. The interview is going to be the full interview, I guess, will be up any day now. But he put a clip up from his interview with Dominic. And Dominic confirmed that there have, in fact, been discussions about him donning a mask when all of this is over, of possibly putting him in a mask. Even though, I mean, everybody already knows what he looks like. But basically, to uphold the tradition of Lucha Libre, he would wear a mask. And possibly taking the Mysterio name, Rey Mysterio. Rey stands for King, so the idea would be that he would be Prince. I don't know if there's a corresponding Spanish word for Prince, but he was saying that they're thinking maybe Prince Mysterio could be a name for him. I call him the Boy Wonder. I just think of Robin. I think of Rey Mysterio as Batman. Here's Robin. Not quite the same relationship, but that's kind of how I look at this. Remember what I pitched on the podcast? I said, send Dominic when this is over. Dominic cannot stay on Monday Night Raw. Dominic is very, very good for his experience level. He's very young, and he's better than a lot of people in the same situation would have been. I mean, his very first match, the first match of this kid's life, not counting practice matches that he's had in training, the very first match that he ever had was a singles match at SummerSlam with Seth Rollins. That's a lot of pressure to put on somebody. And I thought they had a very good match. They had one of the better matches on the SummerSlam card. Now, it didn't hurt to be in there with somebody like Rollins. You know, if you would have put Dominic in there with Tugboat, I'm not sure he could have had the same kind of match. Now I suddenly want to see that match. But as good as he is, he does not belong on Monday Night Raw. When this storyline plays itself out, he needs to go to NXT. Raw and SmackDown should be reserved for the best of the best. It should be reserved for the elite. And Dominic has a ways to go before he gets there. And I think just putting him on Raw and keeping him there is a huge mistake. So my idea was to let him go down, send him down to NXT, and let him follow in his father's footsteps. It sounds like they're already talking about that with the Prince Mysterio name and maybe putting him in a mask. Well, my whole thing was let him fight for the Cruiserweight title. He can probably have some pretty kick-ass matches down there. It's the first major championship in this country anyway, in WCW, that his father won. His father helped make that Cruiserweight division. His father was a huge part of those big successful days of WCW Monday Nitro. And Dominic can follow in his father's footsteps and start out chasing after the Cruiserweight title and then let him work his way up from there. Austin Theory is another example of a young kid brought up to Raw too soon who got sent back down to NXT, and now he's paying his dues down there and he's looked good. So is Dominic. Dominic has proven himself to be more than capable in the ring. But they need to take their time with him. Mandy Rose and Dana Brooke, they are now a tag team on Raw, which is completely random. I'm not sure why they couldn't just wait 2 weeks. They're about to have a frickin' draft. They couldn't wait. They had to do a trade. I think they billed it as a trade. Don't know who got the other end of the trade. But now they're a tag team on Monday Night Raw. They need new teams in the women's division. But here's another example of just taking two singles and just smushing them together and manufacturing a tag team out of nowhere. This just feels like such a downgrade for Mandy Rose. Now, you know what? It doesn't feel like one. It is one. It is a downgrade for Mandy Rose. She had that big win over Sonya Deville at SummerSlam. Now she's just been put in a random team with Dana Brooke. I'm sorry. That's a downgrade. Apollo 13 turned into Apollo 14. We got the 14th fucking straight match with Apollo Crews involving some member of the Hurt Business. I thought we were done with this. I thought it was over. Crews, Ricochet, Mustafa Ali against MVP, Lashley, and Shelton Benjamin. No Cedric Alexander on the show this week, not even a mention. Make of that what you will. I know his wife does work for AEW, so it could be out of an abundance of caution. Maybe he's being kept off the show. I don't know. But Ali got the win with a 450 on MVP. Nice to see Ali get a win. What does it mean? Probably nothing. I'll tell you what it means. It means that he's going to probably wrestle Lashley, and he's going to get squashed. That's basically what it means. I have absolutely no faith left in this company to do anything with this guy. So it is what it is. Drew McIntyre defended the WWE Championship in an open challenge against a returning Bobby Roode, introduced by his partner Dolph Ziggler, so they're keeping that partnership going. Roode has been gone for months. He was unable to travel from Canada due to the pandemic. They had what I thought was a pretty good match, outside of the fact that I never once bought into the idea that the championship was in any real jeopardy. McIntyre won with the Claymore kick. Actually, this was more competitive than I thought it would be. Roode has grown his hair out a little bit. Not quite as much as it was in his TNA days, but that's what it reminded me of. Speaking of the TNA days, Roode's former tag team partner, James Storm, talked to Ryan Satin of ProWrestlingSheet.com. I see that Ryan Satin is leaving ProWrestlingSheet.com, as a matter of fact, but before that announcement, Satin interviewed James Storm, and Storm revealed that he was all set, he was all ready to make his WWE debut earlier this year, the night after, maybe not the night after, but right after WrestleMania. That was the original plan. It probably would have been the night after. They usually save a big return or a big debut for the night after Mania shows. He was all set to debut right after Mania, but the pandemic ruined those plans. And then, of course, they let a whole bunch of people go, and they weren't about to bring in somebody new, like James Storm. So everything got put on hold indefinitely. The only time James Storm has worked in any capacity for WWE were the two matches that he worked for the NXT brand 5 years ago. And they gave him an offer, and he turned down the offer because he got a better offer. He got a better, I think it was more job security, it was more money, a lot more money. if I remember, than what WWE was offering him, to the point that I think Storm even said, Triple H told him, look, take the deal. Like, we can't match it, or we're not going to. Like, you got to look after your family. Take the deal. And they left on good terms. This time around, he was told by Triple H's assistant or his lieutenant, whatever you want to call him, Canyon Seaman, he was told that Paul Heyman wants, he's got some interest in bringing you in to Monday Night Raw. Billy Corgan and Dave Lagana let him out of his NWA contract early. They had an option that they could have rolled over. They could have exercised the option to keep him around for another year. They didn't do it. They did not roll over the option. They let him leave. And they even told him. They said, look, we brought you in here. We wanted you to get an offer from WWE. That was our goal, to try to get you hired by WWE, because you should have already been up there. So he was very appreciative of that. He was willing, you know, he's ready to drop the tag team titles with Eli Drake and do whatever was asked of him. The NWA treated him very well. So they were all on board. Hey, brother, this is your big shot. We're going to let you go. Best of luck. So everything was looking up. He was all ready. He got into the best shape of his life. He said he got down to like 10% body fat. He was paying out of his own pocket. There was somebody in WWE who warned him, watch what supplements that you take, because sometimes it triggers something on the drug test and you don't want to get popped, you know, erroneously. So he was being very meticulous about what he put in his body supplement-wise. He was paying out of his own pocket for monthly drug tests to make sure that his system was totally clean. And he was doing all the right things. He bought new gear. He says he signed the deal. And then COVID put everything on hold. He has not spoken to anybody in the company since the end of July. He was kind of keeping the lines of communication open with them. And then at the end of July, that was the last conversation he had with anybody there. It sucks for him, you know, to come that close. The guy's 43 years old. He's not a young guy anymore. He's 43 years old. Who knows if he'll ever get another phone call from WWE. I think with as dead as their tag team division is right now, putting beer money back together, that would be a welcome addition to help kicks. Now, it's going to take more than just beer money. It's going to take more than just one team. But you put those two guys back together, and even the WWE audience that maybe doesn't know what the hell beer money ever was, you'll have people who do remember them, and they'll pop for them, you know, if you get people back in the buildings by then. But even the people who don't know, the point is, they worked very well. They have a chemistry together as a tag team. They're a real tag team. They're not a manufactured team. And I know that Rude and Ziggler are the ones who have an alliance. Maybe you can keep Ziggler with them. Even Storm said, you know, when he was talking to Satin, he said, you know, we're talking about all kinds of ideas. He goes, you know, maybe you could even put us together as a trio. It could be Rude and Storm and Ziggler. I mean, you can come up with any idea you want to, but Beer Money is a real tag team that has chemistry. They've worked together before. I think they would be a welcome addition to a dead tag team division. Let's do it. Let's do it. I say let's do it. Call the guy back up and bring him in. Let's get Beer Money back together. I mean, it's PG WWE. So instead of beer money, call him milk money. I don't care. Let's just get some actual tag teams on television. Please. The end of the show saw Randy Orton dressed as a janitor. Times are tough. Hey, you know, pandemic. Times are tough. You do what you got to do, right? Randy Orton dressed as a janitor. Took a break from sweeping the floors. And he snuck into the Legends Lounge. He put on a pair of night vision goggles, or what was supposed to be night vision goggles. He turned out the lights. And he presumably beat up all of the legends. Now, I say presumably, not only because we didn't see it, but not a single one of them made a sound as they were supposedly being attacked. Did anybody else find that very odd? Not one scream, not one shriek, no one fighting back, nothing. It was just, you heard things moving like Orton was kicking their ass, but no noise at all from any of the legends or Christian in this room. It's unbelievable. They put the lights back on, and there they were. They were all laid out. I don't know why Orton felt the need to dress like a janitor. This all felt very forced. This all felt very dumb. Some people saying, oh, that's so cool. The night vision thing, that's so cool. It's fucking stupid. What are you talking about cool? Boy, it doesn't take a lot to please some of you people. I thought this was dumb. I get that they don't want to show Flair getting beaten up. There's so many ways you could have done that. But I just thought that that was very dumb. Not even necessarily the idea that he would take out the Legends because he's trying to get back at them for what they did to him. He's trying to get revenge. He's the Legend Killer. I get all that, but really, night vision goggles. Oh my God. Oh my God. But now we're going to get one more match between Randy Orton and Drew McIntyre at Hell in a Cell, which you knew what you were going to get anyway, coming out of the pay-per-view, because Orton had a built-in excuse. You didn't beat me. You had all your old friends beat me. I got attacked by like four different people. You can't beat me straight up. And there it is. There's all the excuse you need to get them in the cell so nobody can interfere. You knew this was coming. Now, already announced for Raw tomorrow night, Bray Wyatt is coming to Raw as a guest. Funhouse Bray. This is not The Fiend. The Fiend attacked Owens on SmackDown, which I'm going to talk about here. But this is from the graphic that I saw. This is Mr. Rogers Wyatt is coming to the Kevin Owens show tomorrow night. Drew McIntyre teams with the Street Profits to take on Randy Orton, Dolph Ziggler, and Bobby Roode. I refuse to call him Robert Roode. Ever since he came back to, he came to WWE up from NXT, the whole Robert Roode thing, he's Bobby. That's what he is. Bobby Roode. My father was Robert. People called him Bobby. So I call him, he'll always be Bobby Roode to me. Now, SmackDown from Friday night, I thought the show opened strong. I thought it ended strong. The stuff in the middle was okay. You know, there was nothing overly wrong with it. SmackDown has been in a bit of a rhythm these past few weeks. It's not going to last. We have a draft coming up. I expect they're just going to blow the whole thing up with the draft. I just know it. They're going to blow the whole thing up in the draft. They're going to blow the whole thing to hell. Roman Reigns, he was out for the crowning. His crowning as the new tribal chief. But he was still very upset that Jey Uso never said the words that he wanted him to hear at the pay-per-view. He wanted Jey Uso to call him the tribal chief. He goes, Paul, you know, you call me the tribal chief. Even his brother Jimmy, he called me the tribal chief. I want to hear it from Jey. And Jey came out. Roman noticed that Jey wouldn't stop staring at the Universal title over his shoulder. He goes, whoa, you want this? You want another shot? I'll give you one. How about that? Hell in a Cell. You got it. You got one more shot. So, at Hell in a Cell, it's going to be Jey Uso challenging yet again for the Universal Championship against Roman Reigns. And as decisive as Roman's slaughter was of this guy, of his cousin at Clash of Champions, I'm fine with them squeezing out one more match with this thing. I think it's been compelling television. I think it has been as compelling as anything involving Roman Reigns in his entire career. Or at least since the Shield. I love the Shield. You guys know I was a big Shield fan back then. But as compelling as anything they've had Roman Reigns doing on television since he split away from the Shield, everything is just, it's just hitting on all cylinders right now. And I have no problem getting one more match out of it. I think Jey Uso did well enough in the build-up to this and in the match. He played his role perfectly that he earned himself one more match before they move on to the next challenger. So, I have no issue with that. AJ Styles came out after Roman left. He was mocking Jey Uso, and that led to a match. And Jey beat him with the Samoan Splash. So, he gets a big win over an established name heading into Hell in a Cell. I'm thinking AJ Styles is headed back to Monday Night Raw. You know, you've got a heel holding the Universal title. You've got a heel holding the Intercontinental title. I don't see AJ changing his affiliation anytime soon. I just don't see there being much else for him to do on SmackDown right now. Unless the draft kind of blows the roster up a little bit and they get some people on that brand who he can now work with. It strikes me that he is probably one of the big names that might be switching to the other brand. A Paul Heyman free brand. I'm sure that'll just be a coincidence, though. I know what he said. AJ said, I have no problem with Heyman being on the same show. I'm a professional, but I don't think AJ would be crying if they moved him to another brand where he didn't have to be in the same building every week with Paul Heyman. My only hope, my only request, if WWE and their moles ever listen to this, I hope that if AJ gets drafted to Raw, please take Joseph Park with him. I want Joseph Park to have an established role on TV, and wherever AJ goes, he must go with him. He must follow. That is my only request. Otis squashed John Morrison, literally squashed him with the Vader bomb for the win. This Friday, he has decided to represent himself in his court case against The Miz. You know, Jeff Hardy's court case, his very real court date, stemming from his DWI arrest exactly 1 year ago, which had already been delayed. It had already been delayed from, I think, April to September. That was the second delay. It has once again been delayed due to COVID. Now it's set for October 22nd, where it will no doubt be delayed again. Maybe they should just do it on SmackDown. They already went and told us that this guy, he's a junkie, he's a drunk. So people already know that. Just put him before a judge on the TV show. I mean, obviously the court system in WWE, they don't wait. We're going to have Otis and Miz litigating their case on TV this Friday. So let Jeff Hardy go before a judge on Friday and just get this over with. May he be sentenced to 500 consecutive hours of watching Monday Night Raw. That's going to be a very long two episodes, let me tell you. Sheamus pinned Shorty G in less than a minute. Literally, this lasted less than 60 seconds. I don't even know that it went 50 seconds. That's how short this was. This was all just a backdrop to play a Big E promo to set up a Falls Count Anywhere match between he and Sheamus for next week on TV. I want Chad Gable to drive to his local Foot Locker. Here's what I want him to do, please. I want Chad Gable to drive to his local Foot Locker. I want him to buy one of those new off-white Nike rubber dunk sneakers that just came out. Buy himself a brand new pair. I want him to lace up those bad boys. I want him to run as fast as his feet will carry him right out of this fucking company. WWE does not deserve Chad Gable. I want him out of this company. I want him out of this company, and I want him to find a home somewhere where he is appreciated and where he is not saddled with a bullshit name like Shorty G. That's what I want. Kevin Owens. He appeared on SmackDown because why the hell not? Kevin Owens show with Alexa Bliss, who is smitten with the Fiend. She's under his spell. So all she could talk about was the Fiend. Kevin Owens said, he's here, isn't he? She goes, he's everywhere. He's everywhere. Then her whole demeanor changed, and she told Kevin Owens to let him in. And the lights went out. The Thunderdome went out. Lights came back on. It was the red light, and the Fiend had Kevin Owens in the mandible claw. And it ended with the Fiend extending his hand out for Alexa Bliss to accept. And Alexa looked into the camera with this devilish look on her face, and they cut to commercial. So look, I'm intrigued by what they're doing here. I kind of like this story. It introduces an interesting little wrinkle into the whole Fiend thing. I don't know how things are going to shake out draft-wise. I can't imagine they break them up. But then again, they just moved Mandy Rose onto Monday Night Raw. So unless she immediately gets drafted back to SmackDown or Otis moves to Raw, that was kind of an abrupt end too to that whole story. Although that might not be done playing itself out yet. Matt Riddle and Lince Dorado and Gran Metalik of the Lucha House Party beat King Corbin, Sheamus, and Cesaro. Riddle with the bro Derek pins Cesaro. What a missed opportunity not to call them the Lucha Bros. But I guess we know why they couldn't do that. Kalisto came out after. He was in the back. He came out after, and he was very upset. He and Lince don't like each other very much. I actually thought Lince Dorado came more across to me as a heel than anything Kalisto's done. Before the match, they were in the back. Metalik, Lince, and Matt Riddle, right before they went out. And they were, I think it was Sarah Schreiber, whoever it was, asked, where's Kalisto? And Lindsay was kind of healing on Kalisto and insulting him, and he came across as more of an obnoxious heel to me than Kalisto does. Maybe Lindsay's the one going heel. But it looks like one of them, and maybe Kalisto, if he's the one they want to push kind of on his own, he may end up on a different brand after next week. If that happens, it's over. Because if you think that Lindsay Dorado or Kalisto is going to split away from the Lucha House Party and, let's say, move to Raw and get a big singles push, yeah, maybe for 2 weeks, and then he's going to be on main event. He's going to be wrestling Humberto and Mustafa Pin Me every single week. It is over for this guy's career. The best thing they could hope for is to keep them all together and keep this story going on TV, because this is more TV time than the Lucha House Party has ever gotten consistently in their entire run so far in WWE. But you can only drag the breakout. You can only drag this out for so long. Once it plays itself out, or you do the first match with Lindsay and Kalisto, which, by the way, that could be a really kick-ass match. But once this all plays itself out, don't fool yourself into thinking that the Lucha House Party or individual members of the Lucha House Party are going to be in a better position. They're going to be higher up on the card. No, they're not. Don't be a fool. You know exactly where these guys are going to end up. It's kind of sad, actually. It's kind of sad. Sasha Banks, she came out in a neck brace, came to the ring, said that next week it's going to be her and Bayley for the SmackDown Women's Championship. They could not even wait for Hell in a Cell. And I think Hell in a Cell was too early. Now they're going to do the first match on TV this Friday. Friday is going to be almost a year to the day that Bayley won the women's title. I think it may only be a day or two short of a full calendar year. Do they, or a full year, do they change the title and then build to the inevitable rematch at Hell in a Cell around the idea that Sasha Banks always fails in her first defense? She can't keep a title. Is that the story? And then ultimately she does retain? Because there's a chance that they may separate them in this brand split. Even if they did, I think that they would allow them to have that one final match together at Hell in a Cell. You know, they've done that before. Somebody gets drafted, but they're allowed to fulfill their obligation. And they go to the pay-per-view, they wrestle whoever their scheduled opponent was. And then after that, they officially move over to the other brand. There is the chance that they will split these two up. But it just feels so rushed to do that because they just did the turn. You could get a few matches out of this. So I think what's more likely here is we're going to get a disqualification finish. We're going to get a non-finish. We're going to get a DQ on TV this week. Bayley maybe uses the chair to keep her title. She is so desperate to keep that title that she has to cheat to do so. And that then leads to a match inside the cell where chairs and all kinds of weapons would be legal. And I think that they can headline that pay-per-view. I know they might want to headline again with Roman Reigns. And again, I love that story with Roman and Jey Uso. But I think you could main event Hell in a Cell with Sasha Banks against Bayley. I said that a month ago. I stand by that. I don't feel any differently about it now than I did then. I think those two should be the main event of that show. As long as this has been building and building and building, even though they're blowing off the first match on TV this week, you could headline with that match. And that should be where Sasha wins the title, not on Fox. Fox may give them the bigger audience, true. You could have 2 million people watching on Fox. You're not going to have 2 million people buying the network to watch the match. So yeah, you'll get the bigger audience on Fox. You'll get all the commercial breaks as well. But I would do the title change inside the cell. That is what you should be building to. To the surprise of no one, Carmella revealed herself to be the mystery woman that we've been seeing vignettes for each week. I'm not sure why she needed to be repackaged. Now she's a heel again. She's untouchable, she says. She's untouchable. That's her thing now. Don't tell that to Corey Graves. But I don't know why there was this need to repackage this woman. Instead of bringing up new faces to the brand, they felt the need to go through this whole thing. Whatever. I really don't care. Earlier in the show, backstage, Sami Zayn dropped the fraudulent Intercontinental title into a garbage can, Medusa style. See, that isn't the title that I would have dropped into the trash. That title's on the other show. That's the belt that I would have put into the trash, not the Intercontinental title. And then Sammy went on to beat Jeff Hardy in the main event. They had a singles match. He retained his championship. It was very nice to see the Intercontinental title headlining. Nobody saw Sammy at first remove one of the turnbuckle pads during Jeff's entrance. The referee didn't see it. We only saw it on a replay later on. And that played into the finish. Jeff was up top. Sammy yanked his legs out from underneath him, and Jeff came down face first onto the exposed steel, and he got pinned. I enjoyed this. Sami Zayn has been gold since he has come back to SmackDown. So the draft begins this Friday. A few years ago, SmackDown got butchered in the draft. What was that, 2 years ago maybe? They got butchered in the draft. They have a good roster right now. I'm hoping that it does not change too dramatically. All they need, you know, you could put a couple of new like faces on the main brand, and yeah, you might find a couple of people to move away. But what they really need, you get them some new tag teams. Get them a couple of new tag teams. Get them a couple of new female faces. Raw got Mia Yim and Mercedes Martino. I'm sorry, Reckoning and Retaliation. SmackDown could use Rhea Ripley. And maybe somebody like a Dakota Kai. They're also promoting Sasha Banks challenging Bayley for the SmackDown Women's title. Kevin Owens going one-on-one against The Fiend. And Big E taking on Sheamus in a Falls Count Anywhere match. So they are loading that show up. And I get that that's the first night of the draft. I get that. But is there something going on that night that I'm not aware of? It just feels to me like there's some big sports competition. Maybe that I'm not aware of. They're loading that show up more than usual. It could just be the fact that it's draft night one. But it almost feels like they think that there's a big baseball game or something. They're going to get killed. There's got to be something going on that night. They're loading this show up more than usual. Both AEW and NXT were up in the ratings this week, up against stiff competition from multiple baseball playoff games, game one of the NBA Finals, and the South Park Pandemic Special, which was number one on all of cable in the key demo. Eric Cartman was the real demo god this week. It wasn't Chris Jericho, it was Cartman. AEW pulled 866,000 overnight viewers, up from 835,000 the week before. NXT brought in 732,000 viewers, which was up from 696,000 the week before. So you like to see both shows go up. They weren't up by that much, but they were up. AEW came in 12th place for the night in the demo. NXT just barely made the top 50. They came in at number 50 in the demo. Sadly, both shows were beat out combined. The combined audience of both these shows were beaten out by what was listed on the demo chart at number 3 on all of cable as baseball rain delay. A baseball rain delay beat out the combined audiences for Dynamite and for NXT. That's very sad. And one quick note here. Last Sunday, Arn Anderson applied to trademark the Four Horsemen for entertainment services. Somebody who knows more about trademarking and copyright laws can perhaps read up on the trademark and any other fine print I may have missed. But it sounds like the sort of thing where if he was granted this mark, could potentially be used, you know, for entertainment services. It could potentially be used, you know, maybe on television for the name of a faction. So maybe the idea all of a sudden of a Four Horsemen faction in AEW going by that very name may not be so far-fetched after all. NXT TakeOver 31 airs tonight on the WWE Network and for the first time ever on traditional pay-per-view as well. Yes, if you want to spend $54.99 to watch TakeOver, you may do so. At least that's how it's priced right now on Verizon Fios. Taking place from the WWE Performance Center, which is going to be NXT's new home going forward. They are moving out of Full Sail for the time being. Triple H this week said the TakeOver will have a very unique look and feel. Something totally different that has not been done so far. And that he hopes it'll be game-changing for the brand. Maybe they're going to all just do holograms. They're moving to all holograms. so that nobody gets infected with COVID. Maybe that's the new revolutionary development here for the NXT brand. Although, if that's the case, they probably would make more sense to do that in the Thunderdome. Got all the lasers, right? All the lasers and the lights. Holograms is just the next logical step. NXT is also going to be moving back to weekly live shows starting this Wednesday. No more week on, week off, like AEW has been doing and NXT has been doing up until now. That ends this week. But first, just some thoughts on the go-home show from Wednesday. Let me talk about this Shotzi Blackheart bump. My God. Shotzi Blackheart, who does not have a match tonight. She has been tearing it up lately, the last few weeks on TV. She had another good match, this time with Dakota Kai, but she also nearly killed herself on a sliced bread on the apron. She landed right on top of her head, right on top of her neck, on what they always tell us is the hardest part of the ring, and time stood still for a few minutes. That was very, very scary. Shotzi is very good. I think Shotzi, she's got a unique look. She's got just a certain charisma and personality about her that I think she, in front of a live crowd, I think she would get herself over very well. She's somebody who I think you could probably plug her into other periods in wrestling history. I think that she, and the risks that she takes when she's in the ring, she would get over almost. She'd probably get over in the old ECW. I think Shotzi is very likable. And I think people would appreciate the fact that she kind of puts herself in harm's way and she puts her body at risk so often the way that she does. The problem is, she's her own worst enemy when it comes to that sort of thing. And she's going to end up hurting herself very badly one of these days. That's how this is going to end. Remember, it was only a few months ago. I think it was in May. This was before the Takeover In Your House show. She did a truss dive out of the ring. So she did a spring. She was on the apron and she basically jumped up onto the middle rope and did a springboard backwards. She did a truss dive. And again, it was Dakota Kai. It was Dakota Kai and Raquel Gonzalez out there. They were going to catch her. They were going to absorb the impact. They were supposed to catch her, but Shotzi overshot it. And she landed right on the back of her neck. You know, sometimes you have the announcer say, oh, I got folded up like an accordion. Well, she got folded up like an accordion. On the floor. Not even in the ring. On the floor. Right on her neck. It was more like a mistrust dive than a trust dive. I thought she killed herself. She's got to protect her neck. She's turning into the Ibushi of NXT. She has got to protect her neck, or else it won't be too long before we read about another spinal fusion. Taking a piece of the hip to put in the neck. She's going to be next on that list. But at least she won the match. Would have been worse if she would have lost. At least she won the match. Cameron Grimes hosted his own invitational and very quickly beat a job guy before Ridge Holland walked out and laid waste to him. Happy to see that Holland is sticking around on NXT and is not being sent back to NXT UK. That tells you they see star potential in this guy, as I do. The NXT UK brand just started up again. They could have easily sent him back overseas if they wanted him back on that show, but they have him on the main show, and that means something. He tossed Cameron Grimes around for a little bit. Wasn't really a match, but he did this on Cameron's birthday, no less. It was Cameron Grimes' 27th birthday. Holland kicked his ass for 27 seconds. I guess that was his birthday gift to him. In the back later on, Grimes was looking for William Regal when he ran into Dexter Lumis, his first appearance on TV since he injured his ankle on that dive before TakeOver 30. That took him out of the North American Championship ladder match. Adam Cole beat Austin Theory. Austin on Austin violence here in this match. Some people may not know that. They may think Adam Cole is his real name. Adam Cole is not his real name. His real name is Austin Jenkins. Hence, Austin beats Austin here in this match. Now, Theory continues to do the honors for everybody that he steps in the ring with. It feels like he's been losing a lot lately, but it's all part of the building process. And every time I see him, he looks good in these matches. Austin Theory comes away even in defeat, looking good in these matches. He's clearly being groomed for much bigger things. So now we get on to tonight's show. Let me run through the lineup for tonight with my predictions. Santos Escobar defends the Cruiserweight Championship against Isaiah Swerve Scott. They had this side-by-side video feature with both guys being interviewed on TV this week that I thought was pretty good. Scott got to cut a promo on Escobar. Escobar responded to Scott. You know, basic stuff building up to the pay-per-view match here. Scott brought up Legado del Fantasma getting involved in their matches before. The one match where Escobar beat him because he used a loaded mask that he headbutted him with. He's always got to cheat. It's always very unfair. Because he says he knows Escobar can't beat him one-on-one. So, very simple story going into this match. I would not take the title off Escobar. I think it's too early for that. So, I'm picking Escobar to retain. Kushida takes on the Velveteen Dream. Whose, boy, has his stock dropped dramatically in the last few months. Ever since that loss to Adam Cole in the parking lot brawl back in June. All the issues around him, Triple H says, nothing there, nothing to see, back on TV, but his stock has dropped dramatically. And we got a Kushida video package on this show. It was in Japanese, and they were translating from Japanese, talking about how the world is about to see the real Kushida. He's going to explode at TakeOver. Kushida has been showing a more aggressive side of late since he came back. I thought they might go with him or Cameron Grimes on this show as Finn Balor's opponent for the championship, but they went with Kyle O'Reilly instead. I think they could be setting up for a Balor-Kushida match, though. And if that's the case, then Kushida needs the win here. So, and either way, I would go with Kushida. Kushida is my pick to win. Io Shirai defends the NXT Women's Championship against Candice LeRae. I would air this match before the North American title match to build to this whole idea that Candice and Johnny might end the night as the first married couple ever to hold NXT gold at the same time. That means the first person needs to win. And I think that's going to be Candice LeRae. I think we're going to get a new women's champion tonight. I think Candice takes the title. That then leads into the North American title match. Damian Priest defending against Johnny Gargano. They booked a mixed tag team main event on NXT this past week. It was Johnny and Candice against Priest and Io. And Johnny and Candice got the win. Of course, they cheated. Candice had given Damian Priest a low blow. So they got the win. And they were posing with the titles when the show went off the air. I think at least one of them needs to win. They've been losing a lot recently. Of the two of them, I think Candice is the more likely candidate. So I have her pegged to win the women's championship. But I think Damian Priest, who's only been champion for a few months, but you know, that doesn't mean you can't take the title off him and then have him fight to win it back. I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't do that. I think you want people to think that both husband and wife are going to win the belts. One of them does. But then Johnny falls short, and Damian Priest retains. And that brings us to the main event, Finn Balor defending the NXT Championship against Kyle O'Reilly. It has been a very interesting year for Kyle O'Reilly. He disappeared for a while when the pandemic hit because he is, and maybe some people don't know this, but he is a diabetic. Kyle O'Reilly has type 1 diabetes, which makes him more susceptible to complications if he was to get COVID. It makes it harder for his body, does the diabetes, to just fight off infection in general. As it is, if you're diabetic, it may take longer for you to heal from injuries if you suffer one. So him being in the ring at all, there's always a risk involved in that. He's been able to manage that risk throughout his career. He wears a glucose monitor, a continuous glucose monitor, on his arm at all times. He takes it off when he wrestles, so you don't see it when he's in the ring. So anyway, he was gone for a few months until he and the company felt that it was safe and he felt comfortable enough to come back. And now for the first time, after being a tag team wrestler for his entire run so far in NXT, he is getting not only a singles push, but here he is challenging for the championship. Boy, did they rush into this. They rushed into this. Makes me wonder why. Why didn't they just take the time to build this up a little bit more? Feels very sudden. I don't know if somebody's moving from one brand to the other, but it does feel rushed. But here he is. He's getting a championship match. They had a great Prime Target video. They do these Prime Target videos before these big takeover matches that are very well done, talking about how he always had his sights on Finn Balor, but they always missed each other. So when he came to America, I guess from, where is he from, Canada? When he came to America, Balor went to Japan. And when he finally made it to Japan, Balor had already left for NXT. And when he finally made it to NXT, Balor went to Monday Night Raw. So they always were just constantly missing each other. They never really had a chance to work together. And now they finally get to lock horns for the first time. And they had a sit-down contract signing before the show. Shawn Michaels was the moderator, I guess you would call, the master of ceremonies. And he introduced the two of them, and this was almost shot in like a cinematic way. They had music playing on, you know, it's like as a bed in the background. And, you know, they just went back and forth, you know, trading little barbs with each other. Balor said he doesn't see Kyle O'Reilly as a secret, because Shawn Michaels had talked about him being kind of the best kept secret in NXT. And Balor said, look, I don't see him that way. He says, that's more of a fringe wrestling fan viewpoint. Balor said he knows how good Kyle O'Reilly is. O'Reilly said that he's going to beat Balor. Balor wondered, hey, you going to show up as a man? Are you going to show up with your Undisputed Era buddies? And Kyle said, no, it's not about the UE on Sunday. This is about me. This is about Kyle O'Reilly. And Shawn Michaels kind of teased the idea, is there going to be conflict in the ranks of Undisputed Era? You know, if O'Reilly wins the championship, could there be some jealousy there? And he kind of laughed it off. O'Reilly said this is Balor's first title defense, and so wrestling logic would indicate he's not going to lose. He goes, but you are going to lose. You're going to lose to me. So I thought this was very good. I think this is going to be just an incredible match. I find it impossible to believe that you're going to put Finn Balor and Kyle O'Reilly in the ring for 15, 20, 25 minutes, and they're going to have anything less than just a kick-ass match. So this is going to be tremendous. But how does it all go down? I could see Roderick Strong and Bobby Fish, who are still being portrayed as heels. It's a very interesting little split right now in Undisputed Era, where Adam Cole is clearly acting more like a babyface would traditionally act. Kyle O'Reilly has been built up like a total babyface in this. Even when he came out a couple of weeks ago in the parking lot and he stopped Tommaso Ciampa from beating up Jake Atlas. Don't forget about Tommaso Ciampa. He's not on this card. He did tell Kyle that he would see him soon. So it's very, very possible that we see Tommaso Ciampa get involved here, and he costs Kyle O'Reilly the championship. And then Kyle can then go into a program, you know, go into a feud with Tommaso Ciampa, and Balor moves on to somebody else. Maybe Kushida is next in line for a title shot. But Roddy and Bobby, who are still, again, portrayed as heels, maybe they run out at a pivotal point in the match to try to help out Kyle. They're trying to help out their friend. But Kyle doesn't want their help. He wants to do this alone. He wants to do this on his own, by himself. And they just can't understand it. And Adam Cole comes out. Adam Cole tells Roddy and Bobby to back off. You know, stand back and stand down, or stand by. So he tells them to kind of back off, and Balor goes on to retain the title. And there's a battle with Cole and O'Reilly against Fish and Roddy. There's a fracture in Undisputed Era. Now, you could always then have Cole turn on Kyle. Maybe Adam Cole isn't such a babyface after all. You know, who do you think you are fighting for the championship? That's mine. I don't think that's going to happen, though. I think they've got Adam Cole in the babyface spot. And so, again, it could make for some interesting times or build to some kind of a tag team match within Undisputed Era. But don't forget about Tommaso Ciampa. He's still lurking. He still hasn't gotten his revenge on Kyle O'Reilly for sticking his nose where it doesn't belong. The end result is no different, though. The end result is going to be a win for Finn Balor. I think Finn Balor retains the championship. And also on this show, we are going to learn the identity of the mystery man or the mystery woman who is returning to NXT, the former champion from NXT coming back to the black and gold brand. Who's it going to be? We've seen these videos on TV with the voice being masked. Who's it going to be? The names I've pitched, if it's a male, Bo Dallas. If it's a female, Ember Moon. Although I don't think Ember Moon is necessarily ready to come back. But those are my picks. I think those are probably the two most likely candidates. And one last update here on Tegan Nox. Tegan Nox definitely does not have a match on this show. Triple H confirmed on that conference call this week that Tegan Nox did, yet again, tear her ACL. He didn't say which knee. She's had ACL tears in both knees. So whichever knee it is, this would be at least the second tear of her ACL, which is no bueno. She's already had surgery to repair the injury, he said. He did not address how the injury happened. He did not address when the injury happened. She has not wrestled a match since the tri-branded Battle Royal on SmackDown in the middle of August. It is now early October. When would this injury have happened? Well, according to The Observer, if Meltzer is to be believed, she didn't suffer the injury in training, like at the Performance Center. She suffered it while rehabbing. So I guess she still does rehab on her knees, because I don't know what else she would be rehabbing. But in rehab, she suffered a torn ACL. That's terrible. I mean, you're not even really doing anything overly strenuous. You're not wrestling a match. She wasn't in a car accident or anything like that. And you tear your ACL. Now, maybe it was a partial tear. I don't know if it's a full tear, partial tear. Maybe it's not as serious as the other tears. He didn't give any specific information, which I thought was very odd. I guess they're not under any obligation to. It's still it's still kind of a HIPAA issue, but this is her third tear in 3 years. She has had tears in both of her knees. The last time her knee, as she explained it, her knee exploded. That was during the Mae Young Classic in the match with Rhea Ripley. And it was a torn ACL, it was a torn MCL, it was a torn LCL. She tore both meniscuses, fractured her left tibia. Her leg was an absolute mess. And she fought back from that. She had to fight back two different times from torn ACLs. And some people might think that that's all the knee injuries that she's had. That's not true. She hurt her knee when she was 13 years old playing soccer or football, I guess, depending on what part of the world you live in, it's football. Other places, like here, it's soccer. But she suffered a knee injury then. I don't know if that was a tear. I don't know what kind of knee injury it was, but she has a history of knee issues going back to when she was only 13 years old. Your body is not even done fully developing at 13 years old. And it was a serious enough knee injury that was the last time she played football. That was it. And then she ended up getting into the pro wrestling and training for that. But this woman now has to carry the label for the rest of her career of being injury prone. There's no avoiding it now. Tegan Nox is injury prone, and it's all right around the knees. Her knees are like rubber bands. And look, I hope she can come back from this. She is only 25 years old. There are people who have come back from multiple ACL tears before, but it's not a good sign. At this point, you got to consider, and I said this on the stream on Wednesday night, on the AEW stream, I talked about this, and I said, quality of life, at some point, quality of life becomes something you got to consider. As young as she is, she's got to consider, how are my knees going to be when I'm 35? How are my knees going to be when I'm 45? What if she comes back and tears it again? How many ACL tears can one person sustain? I wish her well. That's going to be a decision that she has to make. I'm sure Triple H and WWE will give her the chance to come back and will go along with whatever she feels comfortable doing. But this company is going to have to watch this woman like a hawk, and she's going to have to be very careful. But I just don't envision a situation coming out of this. If this is a legitimate injury and not some kind of worked explanation, she's going to show up tonight and beat up Candice. It's always possible, I guess. I think that would be just ridiculous. You know, when he's on these conference calls, this is kind of real talk. He's giving people updates on real injuries and stuff. He's not usually talking about kayfabe stuff. So if he kind of pulled the wool over everyone's eyes, then that's great news for Tegan Knox. I think that's kind of a shitty thing for him to do. But that would be the best outcome for Tegan. But if she is really hurt and she did have surgery and she's, you know, once again recovering from a knee injury, I don't see how this company ever trusts her body and her knees enough to ever put her in any kind of real prime position on TV. Imagine her being called up to Raw or SmackDown and she's really getting over and, you know, she's going to challenge for the championship at a big pay-per-view match or a big WrestleMania match. How do you trust that her knees are going to be able to hold up and she won't tear it again a few weeks before the match? Do they ever trust her in a big position? I don't think they do. But the only thing that she can do is get better and come back and let a certain amount of time go by where she's injury free and she's healthy. And then maybe she can kind of build that trust back up. But if I'm the company, it's very difficult to look at this situation and say, okay, well, can we trust that she's going to be healthy and this isn't going to happen again? It's already happened 3 times. And she wasn't even in the ring this time.
History has been made here!
This week in wrestling history, it's a big one this week. It's a very busy week. We begin. 45 years ago this week, on October 4th, 1975, the plane crash that nearly changed the course of wrestling history. Ric Flair, David Crockett, Bob Bruggers, Mr. Wrestling Tim Woods, and Johnny Valentine, the father of Greg the Hammer Valentine, big star in his own right, were all riding aboard the same twin-engine Cessna, heading from Charlotte to Wilmington, North Carolina for their next show. Because of the weight of all the wrestlers, the pilot, who was a 28-year-old Vietnam veteran, he made the decision to dump some fuel. He was going to empty some fuel from the gas tank to allow them to take off, but he did not distribute their weights evenly. That was the other mistake he made. Valentine noticed that they were out of gas. At some point during the flight, he looked over and said, "Hey, we're out of gas." And the pilot told him not to worry. The wing tanks are full. We're fine. But then they started to go down. And all of a sudden, they weren't so fine. And the pilot started to panic. He started screaming. Valentine slapped him right in the face to try to get him to come to his senses. He told people that had the pilot not panicked, he said, you know, after the accident, he said, had the pilot not panicked, they could have landed that plane safely. Instead, they ended up crashing about 100 yards short of the runway. They narrowly missed running right into a water tower, which would have all but certainly killed everybody on board had that happened. Instead, they hit some trees and they nosedived into a railroad embankment. The pilot died from his injuries 2 months later. He was in a coma. He never came out of it. Bruggers and Valentine both broke their backs and they never wrestled again. Valentine was paralyzed and in a wheelchair for the rest of his life as a result of the crash. Flair broke his back in 3 different places. But he was able to get back in the ring. Less than a year later, he was already back in the ring. After just a period of months, Ric Flair, with a broken back in 3 places, was back in the ring wrestling. Flair was originally supposed to be sitting next to the pilot up front, not Johnny Valentine. Flair was up front at first. Valentine said that Flair was scared to be up there and he was whining about it. So finally, Valentine had enough. He said, "Look, get in the back. I'll sit in the front." Just imagine how things would have been different. How differently things would have turned out if Flair would have stayed up in that front seat. 30 years ago, on October 2nd, 1990, in this small town of Ponoka, Alberta, Canada, famous at the time for its, I guess, local mental institution. That was its big claim to fame, according to Chris Jericho. A 19-year-old Chris Jericho made his in-ring debut against Lance Storm at the Moose Hall in front of 100 people. They wrestled to a 10-minute draw, and then they came back out at the end of the night, wrestled in a battle royal that Storm won. Jericho's payoff for that night was a cool $30. Or as wrestlers would probably say, gas money. 21 years ago this week, on October 3rd, 1999, came what at the time was the blockbuster announcement that head WWE writers Vince Russo and Ed Ferrara had left the company. They quit the company and they jumped ship to WCW. After a secret meeting with WCW management, both men were working without contracts at the time. Ferrara had gone to Vince McMahon before about wanting to sign a contract. That's how, I guess, he had always done things before he came to wrestling, before he came to WWE. He wanted to sign a contract. He was told, well, that's not how things are done around here. So they were not tied down to any piece of paper. They played an instrumental role in the success of the WWE product during the Attitude Era, in collaboration, of course, with all the talent and the wrestlers themselves. Nobody can take that away from them. Nobody is denying the success that they enjoyed during those years. I cannot say the same thing for Russo's ideas post-WWE, but no doubt he had a hand in a lot of memorable moments on television while he was working for Vince McMahon. And their workload doubled with the addition of SmackDown. They already felt burned out. They were working nonstop. They were barely home. They were barely seeing their families. And they didn't even get a pay bump when they added these. They added 2 hours of television with the SmackDown show. Didn't even get a pay bump. It's like, here's 2 more hours of TV that we need you to write. So they wanted out. Russo told Wade Keller that he was making $350,000 a year at the time. And he said Vince McMahon always took care of him money-wise. You know, did he want to make more money? Of course, everybody wants to make more money. But it was never a case where Vince McMahon was, you know, paying him peanuts or anything like that. He was being paid generously in the six figures. And again, he told Keller that at his peak, I guess, or at that time, he was making $350,000. And he went to Vince McMahon. He didn't have the guts to quit. But deep down, he was hoping to get fired. He kind of wanted to get fired, but he didn't want it bad enough where he was going to walk in and go, I quit. Or, hey, Vince, you know, fuck you. And Vince would turn around and fire him. But that's what he wanted. That's what he says he wanted. He wanted Vince to fire him. He told him, I want $1 million a year, which he knew he would never get. And he told Vince, he goes, I want to move my family closer to where my wife's family lives because I'm working so many hours, I'm never home. I want them to move closer to her family. And one of the things, if not the thing, that sealed the deal for Russo in terms of his decision to leave was Vince McMahon's response to that request, which was that he said McMahon told him, Vince, you make enough money. Why don't you just hire a nanny? And that showed him that McMahon just didn't understand what he was going through. He didn't get it. That and he and Ed Ferrara were also increasingly upset and bothered by the fact that whenever they would read an interview with Vince, like a magazine interview or something about the explosion of popularity of the WWF, it would always be Vince McMahon who would be taking, or like even behind the scenes, I guess, Vince McMahon would be taking credit for all of these different things. He would be the one taking credit for all of these ideas. And when he would do magazine interviews and he would cite somebody else, he would mention Shane. He would mention Shane McMahon and credit him as being a creative driving force, you know, behind the scenes in the company. And that upset them because they were never given credit for their contributions publicly. So it was less of an issue, but it was still something that bothered the two of them. So Russo called up WCW. They flew him out to Atlanta right away. And within 48 hours, the deal was done. All while Vince McMahon was overseas with the roster in Europe, they had a Rebellion pay-per-view in Birmingham. And so that's where they weren't even on American soil. They were out of the country. When Russo decided to call WCW, he flew, he met with them, he did the deal. It was like in the dark of night, you know, this deal was pulled off. So you can imagine when Vince McMahon landed back in the States and Russo called him on the phone to give him the news, he was none too happy. You know, McMahon relied a lot on Russo and Ferrara to the point where, according to the two of them, there were times, you know, back in those days, 99, where Vince wouldn't even look at the script. McMahon would not even look at the script for the show all the time because he trusted them that much. He's like, all right, let's just go with what's here. And the company at the time was just weeks away from going public. They were launching their IPO. I think it was 2 weeks later. All of a sudden, WWE just lost its top two writers. And they had this extra 2 hours of television every week that had to be written. Russo said he had already submitted his script for Raw that Monday. I don't know about SmackDown, but probably Raw and SmackDown. He didn't leave them in a lurch. He at least wrote, you know, had the television already done and written for that week. It's funny. He mentioned that that Raw show that Monday, which was the show that they wrote, was to have had Chris Jericho pinning The Rock in the main event. That was the only thing Russo claims when he watched the show that Vince McMahon changed. I guess he kept everything else that he had written. But the part about Jericho beating The Rock, he changed. Rock ended up beating Jericho instead. And when Russo was on Talk as Jericho, he told Chris, he goes, look, Chris, as big as you went on to become, bro, if they would have gone with the finish that we wrote, bro, you would have gotten over 2 years earlier than you did if you would have beaten The Rock on that night, bro. So, Russo leaving turned out to be a game changer. Just not in the way that Russo probably expected. WWE went on to have, in my opinion, creatively, the best year that they have ever had in the year 2000. That's even with all of the McMahon overload on TV. And there was way too much McMahon on TV. And back then, you know, more so than now, here we are 20 years later, there were still stories playing out with the McMahons that I guess, I don't even know if you can call it fresh even then, but it was kind of still fresh. But still, way too much McMahon influence on TV that year. Even with that, they lost their head writer. They lost their top star to injury when Steve Austin went down with the neck surgery. They were forced to build a whole bunch of new faces. And it was the best thing they could have done. Rock took the baton. Triple H came into his own as a headliner. Rikishi and Too Cool, they got over with their act. The Radicals came in, so that gave them a boost. With Eddie and Benoit and Malenko and Saturn. You had Kurt Angle coming into his own. One of the best rookie years that anybody has ever had. It's probably neck and neck with him and Brock Lesnar as far as the best rookie year ever in WWE. Chris Jericho became a bigger star. Edge and Christian, the Hardys and the Dudleys, they came into their own, the whole TLC thing. So 2000 was a fantastic year for WWE. Not so much for WCW. And you can't lay all of that at Russo's feet. WCW was already on its way down even before he came in. But whatever magic touch he thought he had in WWE, we never got to see it in WCW. Now, a year before Russo left the company was one of those nights that I have to assume that he may have come up with himself, that I look back on as one of the most fun episodes of Monday Night Raw that I have ever watched. 22 years ago, on September 28th, 1998. The night after the Breakdown in Your House pay-per-view, where Stone Cold was pinned simultaneously by Kane and The Undertaker, and with no obvious winner, Vince McMahon ran off with the Smoking Skull belt. He held the title up. The next night on Raw, they brought back the Winged Eagle belt, albeit for one night only. It was just sitting in a glass case. They were going to present the championship to the new champion. Is it Undertaker? Is it Kane? I don't know. They're going to crown a new champion that night. When Stone Cold crashed the ceremony in a Zamboni, he drove a Zamboni to the ring and rammed the ring. I mean, when I say he rammed the ring, he moved the ring. You could physically see the ring moving a couple of inches. So he rammed right into the side of the ring and he jumped off and clobbered Vince McMahon. I swear to you, the electricity in the building that night for this entire segment could have powered an entire stadium. That's how electric it was. As a fan, I would have killed to be in the building that night. Austin got let out in handcuffs, and when they came back, the madness continued. It didn't end there. This was Vince McMahon's very bad day. This had to be two of the hottest back-to-back segments they've ever done, like back-to-back like this, in the history of Monday Night Raw. because as hot as that segment was and Austin got taken away, they came back from commercial. Vince McMahon was kind of getting his bearings. He had just been attacked. He's kind of getting his bearings back. He's back in the ring. It's just him and Kane and The Undertaker. And we still have to figure out who the champion is, right? We're not done yet. And Vince McMahon says, because I was assaulted by Stone Cold, he chewed Undertaker and Kane out for not living up to their end of the deal, I guess, and taking Austin out and protecting him. So you didn't live up to your end of the deal. I'm not going to live up to mine. And instead of announcing a new champion, he said, I'm going to make you fight for it. He goes, at the next pay-per-view, Judgment Day, it's going to be Kane and The Undertaker one-on-one to crown a new WWF champion, and Stone Cold Steve Austin is going to be the guest referee for the match. And then he looked at the two of them, and he said, it's like dealing with the handicapped. And he looked at Kane, and he said, one's physical. And he looked over at The Undertaker, and he said, and the other is mental. And he said, good luck to you both. And he went to go walk off, and Undertaker said, I don't think so. He grabbed Vince by the shoulder. He took the microphone. And The Undertaker, just great line, just great dialogue here. Undertaker, he takes the mic, and he says, if you ever get out of line with either one of us, you're going to be the one handicapped. And that I will promise. And he shoved the mic back into Vince's chest. And they kind of separated. Nobody left the ring, but like Undertaker and Kane kind of looked in the other direction. Vince threw the microphone down. And with their backs turned to Vince McMahon, Vince decided he's going to flip the both of them off. So he flipped them, or he went to go flip them the double bird. As he's flipping them the double bird, Undertaker turns around and he catches Vince in the act. And I think Jim Ross on commentary said, uh-oh. And that was it. Undertaker nailed Vince. He's beating the shit out of him. Kane starts stomping him. Kane and Undertaker are stomping Vince. The place is going nuts all over again. Jerry Lawler is freaking out. Call 911. Undertaker has like a grapevine or a leg vise on Vince's his leg, his knee. Jim Ross is losing his mind. He's ripping. He's tearing. And this all ended with them dragging Vince outside the ring. They picked up the ring steps and they placed his ankle on top of the bottom part of the steps. And they smashed his ankle with the ring steps. And he sold it like he, you know, had a broken ankle. Which is what ended up giving us, because they took him to the hospital, it's what ended up giving us another classic segment the following week with Dr. Austin whacking him over the head in the hospital with a bedpan. And then the week after that is when Austin filled up McMahon's Corvette with cement. I was at that show. That was at the Nassau Coliseum. And then after the show that night, I was annoying Draws and Road Warrior Animal at the in the lobby of the Marriott Hotel right next door. As they were trying to go into the hotel bar, I think they put their shit away upstairs. They came down. A lot of the wrestlers were filing into the bar. I was too young to get into the bar. I was just young enough I wasn't allowed into the bar. But I'd say it was probably me and about half a dozen other little teenage brats are bothering these two. They were cool about it, though. They were cool about it. 15 years ago, on October 1st, 2005... wrestling fans were treated to a dream match in Ring of Honor when Samoa Joe battled Pro Wrestling Noah's Kenta Kobashi for the very first time ever inside the Grand Ballroom of the New Yorker Hotel. The last time Ring of Honor ran the New Yorker Hotel was my first live Ring of Honor show. Less than a year after this. Yeah, that, I think my first live show was less than a year after this. And I'm sorry it wasn't this show. I'm very sorry I didn't have a chance to be at this show. The crowd was legendary that night. The match was legendary. The crowd was legendary. Maybe the best match to this day in Ring of Honor history. There's a lot of people who would say that. A lot of people who were there that night, but even the people who weren't would say this is probably the best match in Ring of Honor history, going all the way back to 2002. No titles on the line, just a special attraction. And Kobashi was very hesitant to even do it because he was worried about what kind of reaction he would get coming to the States. Joe told Steve Austin on his podcast a number of years ago that Kobashi was worried about coming in and getting the kind of reaction that somebody like Mr. Fuji would get here in the States, figuring, oh, he's the bad guy, he's the evil foreigner, he's going to get booed and mocked and made fun of. He didn't understand how adored he was by those Ring of Honor fans. Those are the fans who read the newsletters and they traded tapes and they knew who Kobashi was, right? They knew Kobashi, they knew Misawa, and they had a tremendous amount of respect for those two, but he didn't know that. He didn't realize that. And when he walked out, he realized very quickly, based on the reaction he got, wow, these people love me. These people respect me. And they had an epic battle. Kobashi got his hand raised. Think about this. In the span of less than 1 month, Samoa Joe wrestled what a lot of people still consider to be the greatest match in TNA history. At their Unbreakable pay-per-view, that was the Triple Threat main event against Chris Daniels and AJ Styles. And then a few weeks later, maybe the greatest match in Ring of Honor history against Kobashi. Joe was on fire that year. If WWE had taken an interest in Samoa Joe earlier than they did, because back then, and even when he was, you know, in TNA, they took one look at him and said, we're not interested in him. Because at that time, he didn't look like the kind of wrestler that they were looking for and they were interested in. But imagine if they had taken an interest in Joe back then, all those many years ago, when they had people like CM Punk floating around in developmental. What if they had taken an interest back then in Samoa Joe? I'll tell you one thing that I know, he would have had a lot more success in that company than he has so far. He's carved himself a nice little gig out right now doing commentary, and he's had some pay-per-view main events. I'm not going to say Joe has been completely mistreated or anything like that. Joe's also had a problem in recent years of staying healthy. As he's gotten older, his body, he's taken a lot of abuse. And Samoa Joe, you know, a lot talking about Tegan Knox before, but Samoa Joe, you know, thankfully no ACL tears, but he's taken a lot of abuse and he suffered a lot of injuries. So we haven't really seen the version of Samoa Joe in WWE that a lot of people remember from those days in Ring of Honor and TNA. And it's a shame because he could have been, he should have been, a star on the level of a CM Punk or a Daniel Bryan who got over and became big stars and they were world champion. That should have been Samoa Joe in WWE. And we never got to see it. But what if? What if they would have taken an interest in him 10 years earlier than they did? 2 days later, on October 3rd, 2005, WWE returned to USA Network after 5 years on Spike TV with their big homecoming episode of Monday Night Raw, which featured a 30-minute Iron Man match between Kurt Angle and Shawn Michaels. They fought to a time limit draw. Michaels challenged him to sudden death. Kurt just walked to the back. Edge beat Matt Hardy in a Loser Leaves Raw ladder match, ending their feud. God, Matt came out looking like such a loser in that feud. Eric Bischoff got himself a WWE Championship match against John Cena. And I'll give you one guess as to who won. Stone Cold Steve Austin. He made a special appearance that night. He gave stunners to all four members of the McMahon family, including one of the absolute worst stunners that I have ever seen anybody take, courtesy of Linda McMahon. She didn't even take the stunner. She sort of pushed herself away as she fell down. I'll tell you this much. It was not as bad as the worst stunner that I have ever seen. And the worst stunner that I have ever seen was taken by her husband on a random episode of Monday Night Raw back in 2001. This was during the Alliance period. So I want to say somewhere maybe around October. It might have been the night that Kurt Angle went heel and joined the Alliance. Now, he ended up being a mole for WWE. But it might have been the night that I think Angle turned heel and was whacking everybody in the head with chairs. There's bodies everywhere. Austin picks up McMahon. I know what it was. I think Vince had a match that night with Shane. Austin picks up Vince McMahon, who's exhausted after everything, after the match and everything that's gone down. And he gave him a kick to the gut. And he went to go give him a stunner, but Vince fell. He fell too soon. He fell early. And Austin ended up going down for the move anyway. It looked absolutely atrocious. Just atrocious. So I don't want to hear that Linda McMahon took the worst stunner ever. The worst stunner ever still belongs, in my opinion, to Vince McMahon on that episode. Even that ghost stunner that Tim White, the referee, took on Sunday Night Heat many years ago. That's just fucking hilarious. That wasn't even as bad. You got to find that Vince stunner. There's absolutely nothing worse than that Vince McMahon stunner. Now, Mean Gene Okerlund, he did an interview later on in this homecoming show. They were obviously pressed for time because they rushed the shit out of this. They had Hulk Hogan come out. Old school Hulk Hogan. Well, let me tell you something, Mean Gene promo. The two of them in the ring together. And this was maybe a 2-minute segment before they ended it. But Hogan came out and he asked the fans, what would happen? He posed the scenario. What would happen if the Hulkster were to one day step into the ring with the Texas Rattlesnake? And the place went nuts. Now, there were rumors at that time that WWE was trying to put together a Hogan versus Austin match for WrestleMania 22 in Chicago. And imagine that match in front of a Chicago crowd. Imagine that. The problem is, nobody bothered to tell Austin about any of this. In fact, I think he may have already left the building after his segment was over. He may have already left. He didn't stick around, I don't think, to see the Hogan segment. I think he may have found out about it after the fact. But either way, that's not even relevant. The fact is, he didn't know that Hogan was coming out and basically cutting a promo, teasing a match. That's exactly what they wanted the fans to think. They wanted the fans to think, oh my God, we're going to get a WrestleMania match. This is the first little seed being planted. We're going to get to see Hogan against Austin. The two biggest stars of all time, one-on-one together in a match at WrestleMania. That's exactly what they wanted people to think. That's exactly what they wanted people to get excited about. Austin was pissed because nobody told him about this, and he had no interest in wrestling Hulk Hogan. He had already retired, so physically, maybe in his mind, he just felt he couldn't do it. But he was not enamored with the idea of wrestling Hogan, and he had said years later, you know, he just thought the match would be the shits. And it was very important to him that if he were to ever come back and get back in the ring, especially after a long layoff like that, that he didn't want to come back and have a shitty match. So the match never did happen, and he regrets that. He regrets that he and Hogan now, looking back on it, never had the chance to get in the ring together. I put that more on Austin because Austin, I think, had multiple opportunities to make the match happen. It was his choice not to do it. And maybe he's right. Maybe the match would have been shit. Maybe it wouldn't have been as good as Hogan and Rock. It would have had to be smoke and mirrors. I mean, they weren't going to go out there and have this, knockdown, drag-out type match. But again, it would have been similar to Hogan Rock in that it doesn't have to be a technical masterpiece. You've got these two guys who can just, I mean, they can make people lose their minds just based on who they are. You don't even need to do much. That match would have been gigantic. I think even then, even in 2006... that match would have been gigantic. But we never got it. Play it in the video game if you want to know what the outcome of that match would be. 13 years ago this week, on October 1st, 2007, we got a first-time ever match on Monday Night Raw between John Cena and Mr. Kennedy. 6 days before John Cena was to have defended the WWE title against Randy Orton at No Mercy in a last-man-standing match. That match ended up not taking place when about a minute or so into this match here, maybe not even a minute between Cena and Kennedy, John Cena gave Kennedy a hip toss. And on a hip toss, John Cena tore his pectoral muscle. I think it was his right pectoral muscle. And you could tell the moment it happened. If you go back and watch the beginning of that match, you could see exactly where the injury happened. To Cena's credit or his stupidity, he finished the match with a torn pec. And it was a pretty severe tear. He finished the match. He wrestled a few more minutes. He beat Kennedy. And then he took not one, but two RKOs from Randy Orton. One in the ring when Orton immediately came into the ring when the match ended. And he hit him with an RKO. And then also on the announce desk. So I'm sure for Cena, that didn't feel too good. I'm sure Orton had no idea. Orton probably had no idea that Cena was even hurt. So Cena ended up being stripped of the title. And that ended his reign as champion. He had been champion for 380 days, over 1 year. as WWE champion. That was the long, at that time, that was the longest WWE title run since Hulk Hogan had his big 4-year run with the belt back in the 80s. Now, CM Punk later on went on to be champion for 434 days, but this predates the CM Punk run. So Vince McMahon, they get to No Mercy 6 days later. They open the pay-per-view, and Vince McMahon opens the show by handing the championship over to Randy Orton and crowning him as the new WWE champion. He then had a match with Triple H. That was the opening match, and Orton immediately lost the belt to Triple H. So we went from John Cena as the champion to Randy Orton being handed the belt to Randy Orton posting himself in the corner and being rolled up and pinned, and now Triple H is the champion. Triple H had another match. He beat Umaga, and then they came back in the main event. It was Triple H and Orton in a last man standing match. And that's when Orton won the belt back. So you talk about playing hot potato with the title. They played hot potato with the title in one night. We were told John Cena would miss anywhere from 6 months to a year with the injury. He was back in 3.5 months. That's when he made his surprise return in the Royal Rumble match in 2008. Madison Square Garden came out in the number 30 spot. I can tell you from being there live, as hated as Cena was in those days, and in New York it was no different. It's one of those markets where you would expect that he would be booed out of the building. When his music hit and he walked out, the place went apeshit. They forgot. They forgot they were supposed to hate this guy. And they lost their minds. And it was a great moment. It was a genuine surprise. Because nobody was expecting him back. But as soon as he got into the ring and the music ended, it's as if everybody just said, oh shit, we're supposed to hate this guy. And they started booing him again. But whether they want to admit it or not, there were a lot of grown men marking the hell out in the building that night for John Cena. And it was 1 year ago this week, on October 2nd, 2019, that pro wrestling returned live to TNT for the first time in almost 20 years since the WCW Monday Nitro days. It was the premiere of AEW Dynamite, running head-to-head with NXT on USA, which had Adam Cole beating Matt Riddle to retain the NXT championship. Shayna Baszler successfully defending her NXT women's title against Candice LeRae. And Finn Balor making his return to NXT. Meanwhile, over on Dynamite, Cody beat Sammy Guevara. Nyla Rose won the women's title from Riho. And Chris Jericho, Santana, and Ortiz beat the Elite in a six-man tag, which ended with the debut of Jake Hager and the formation of the Inner Circle. The Young Bucks have since revealed that the original plan that they had in mind for that first episode of Dynamite was to hold the show at Madison Square Garden. I don't know if they would have been able to pull that off or not, but that was their idea. They would have Dynamite live from MSG. And there's no doubt in my mind they would have sold out. Big show like that, premiere, live, TNT, New York being a big wrestling market. Easily, they would have sold that show out. And so they would have run the garden, and it would have ended with AJ Styles, Luke Gallows, and Karl Anderson debuting for a Bullet Club reunion. I guess maybe the Bullet Club would have, they would have turned on them and left them laying, but that was their original idea. Before AJ decided to take the money that WWE was offering him and stay, and Anderson and Gallows followed suit and ended up doing the same. But the significance cannot be, you cannot really discount the significance of Dynamite premiering on TNT. Even if you're not an AEW fan, you're just being naive if you don't think that Dynamite debuting a year ago this week was a game-changing event in the wrestling business. Yes, wrestling is not booming again. Head-to-head, they're pulling in 5 million viewers in a single night. Most weeks, it's a struggle for NXT and AEW to combine for 1.5 million. That is true. Those days that people remember, 5, 6, 7 million people watching wrestling in a single night, those days are over. Those days, they ain't ever coming back. Those days are in the rearview mirror. The interest level in wrestling today is not what it was 20 years ago. It's not. But having an alternative for fans, having an alternative for wrestlers, and when I say alternative, it's not as if the AEW product is radically different from what you see on WWE television. You have a mix of great wrestling with some silly gimmicks and comedy stuff. Like, it's all there in terms of that sort of thing. I tend to think that what AEW, in terms of them putting their show together every week, Dynamite is a much more consistently enjoyable show than Raw or SmackDown. SmackDown could have 2 weeks in a row of just great television and then be absolute dog shit for the next three. Raw is dog shit on a lot of weeks, way more than it should, given the talent that they have. And it's maddening because there's no reason for it. NXT generally is still a good show. It doesn't have the same kind of life and energy that they had when they had fans in the building at Full Sail. Nothing you can really do about that right now. But NXT continues to be a consistently good show. Some weeks it's very good. But you have an alternative now. If you are sick of WWE, if you don't like WWE, all of a sudden you have this new wrestling league that just popped up. And it has some new faces, and it has some faces that you would know who came from WWE, like Chris Jericho, and now they have Brody Lee and Jake Hager and, you know, all Dustin Rhodes and Cody and all these people that you used to be able to see over there. Yeah, they have a lot of that here too. But there's also a lot of talent that you never would have even known about. You have an alternative. If you don't like one, maybe you'll like the other. And for the wrestlers, it's fantastic because now they have another place to go that seemingly pays pretty damn well. It's not like they pay peanuts. And if you have a big enough name, you can make a very nice living for yourself working in AEW and have the benefit, possibly, of being able to work dates outside the company, as a lot of those people do. You don't have that freedom and luxury in WWE. You're locked into a contract and they're your master. You serve them. And that's how it works. So regardless of whether or not you like AEW, this was a game-changing event for all of those reasons. Especially for the talent. It gives them another place to go. I guarantee, I don't even know the exact number, but there already in the last year have been so many wrestlers, and Randy Orton admitted that he did this. But he's not the only one. A lot of wrestlers who teased that they might go to AEW, maybe they even had a conversation with AEW and Tony Khan and the Bucks, but they only did it to get more leverage so they can get more money out of WWE. Why do you think Anderson and Gallows got contracts for $750,000 a year each? You think they would have gotten contracts of that size if AEW wasn't a thing? Or some of the other guys that got big money deals, you think WWE would have given them that kind of money without AEW being around? You're out of your fucking mind. So there's a lot of reasons why having this new wrestling company sprout up and get the kind of slot they did on TNT was a hugely positive thing for the wrestling business. Even if you just despise AEW, you hate the product, you don't like it, you don't like Cody or the Bucks or whatever, whatever your excuse is, that's fine. But this was something that the wrestling industry needed for a very long time. They needed somebody to try to step into that number two spot. Impact kind of flirted with it a number of years ago, when they were pulling 2 million fans a week on TV for all of a few weeks. There was some promise there. Unfortunately, they crashed and burned. And they've had to reinvent themselves a whole bunch of times. And they have a good product now. And they have a lot of talent there. Impact is still around. But there's no buzz. There's no buzz. Very few people watch. Nobody talks about them anymore the way they used to. Ring of Honor, you know, good product. But nobody really talks about them. It's all about visibility. They got tremendous visibility when they got that deal on TNT. So that was a very big day in wrestling history. And it was 2 days later, on October 4th, 2019, SmackDown made the move to Fox. This was WWE's return to network television for the first time since the early SmackDown days on UPN. This marked the end of Kofi Kingston's six-month run as a WWE champion. He lost to Brock Lesnar in 8 seconds. He went down to a single F5. That was the only move of the match. And then we had former UFC heavyweight champion Kane Velasquez coming on out with Rey Mysterio, making his WWE debut, taking down Brock, the man that he beat in the UFC. And that set up their one and done match a few weeks later in Saudi Arabia. It went 2 minutes, Brock beat him, and that was it. We never really saw him again after that. WWE had signed Velasquez to a multi-year contract, but then they cut him. They released him in the wave of COVID cuts back in April. So it's going to be a very short video package when Cain Velasquez is eventually inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame. You're not going to have a lot of footage. So you got to make the most of those highlights from SmackDown when he walked out, and then Saudi, maybe a couple of Raw appearances. What a career. What a career that Cain Velasquez had for himself. So that was a very busy week. Not all the weeks are usually that packed, but that was a very busy week, very significant week in wrestling history. I love taking you guys down memory lane. And I love getting your questions, too. We're going to cut things off here because we do have a takeover show tonight, and I want to get this up with my predictions before it gets too late. But email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. All your questions, if you have buy or sells, anything like that, comments, suggestions, anything like that, I want to hear from you. Follow me on Twitter, @solomonster. I'll be live tweeting during some of these big events. Not all the time, but sometimes. And I get the polls up. You can vote. Thumbs up, thumbs down. I will be live tonight again. I will remind all of you as soon as TakeOver goes off the air. I want you to come on over to the YouTube channel. Just type in Solomonster Sounds Off. You'll see the logo. Hit that subscribe button. I have a very special video that was sent to me this morning by a listener. I know what it is. I haven't watched it yet. I'm going to watch it for the first time along with all of you live on the stream tonight. I won't say what it is. It's kind of a cool thing, but again, I haven't watched it. I haven't watched it yet. I'm going to save it. I'm going to wait, and you guys can watch it along with me live tonight on YouTube, so hopefully you will join me there. And don't forget, prowrestlingtees.com/SolomonsterSoundsOff. We got our brand new 13-year anniversary t-shirt is up in the spirit of the 13th. Go check it out. I love this shirt. I love it. And shout out to Steve Mello for all of his help in coming up. Well, once we started, I pitched the concept and we started talking about it. I just love how it turned out. And hopefully you do too. And you'll buy a shirt. And you got plenty of time for it to ship to you too. The 13-year anniversary isn't for another month. But it fits the whole Halloween theme perfectly. So go to prowrestlingtees.com/SolomonsterSoundsOff. Pick up a shirt. Let me know if you do. And when you get your shirt, take a picture with it. Tweet it to me. You can share it with the world. Have yourselves a fantastic rest of your weekend. I hope you will join me tonight live. I will see you for episode 673 of The Sound Off next Sunday. So until then, be well, stay safe, have yourselves a great week. I'm hoping to as well. This is going to be a bit of a different birthday this year because I can't really go anywhere or do anything. unfortunately. But yes, I am celebrating a birthday on Tuesday. I'll be with you again live. We'll have a little birthday stream action on Wednesday for Dynamite. So yeah, we'll have some birthday fun this week. It's terrible. I haven't hung out with any friends since March because that's the way it has to be. But I look back on it now that the birthday is here, it reminded me like, shit, I haven't seen anybody since March. It's now October. And you start to get a little lonely and you start to get a little depressed when you don't get to see people. So, but unfortunately, that's just the way it has to be. But I get to be with all of you. It's not like I'm alone, right? I got all of you to join me. I'll see you for 673 next Sunday, and I'll see you for the TakeOver stream later tonight. Until then, guys, have yourselves a great week. I'll see you then.
The Solomonster Sounds Off.
This is the same Lana, by the way, who admitted this week that she and Rusev had sex on top of the tank that Rusev rode out to the ring at WrestleMania 31. Anybody can make a claim like that, really. Look, I was at that WrestleMania. I could sit here and tell you that I had sex on top of that same tank that weekend with a lady friend. And guess what? You'd have no way to prove me wrong.
Oh my God.
So now you're all going to be wondering. Chew on that.
The Solomonster Sounds Off, available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/thesolomonster for Sound Off extras and more. And follow The Solomonster on Twitter, @Solomonster.
Solomonster.
Put that cigarette out.
Solomonster Sounds Off.